This is FMT Magazine, issue number 51 for autumn 2020. FMT is the official journal of the United Grand Lodge of England. The editor is Donna Hardy. The editorial panel is Michelle Warville, Sean Butler, Guy Roberts, Martin Cherry, Julian Perry also is the culture editor. It is published by Sunday, 207 Union Street, London SE10LN, on the web at www.wearesunday.com for the United Grand Lodge of England, based at Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street, London, WC2B5AZ. The editorial manager is Sean Butler. For Masonic inquiries, you can email editor at freemasonrytoday.com or call 020-7831-9811. Also on the web at www.ugle.org.uk. The magazine is copyright the United Grand Lodge of England 2022. The opinions herein are those of the authors or persons interviewed only and do not reflect the views of the United Grand Lodge of England or Sunday. Now let's have a look at the contents page, giving us an idea of what's coming up in the rest of the magazine. And we'll start in a few moments with the welcome from the Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe. That's Dr. David Staples. He welcomes you to the autumn issue. And then in the out and about section, there's news and views from the provinces. And then there are four stories: Community Spirit, 60 Seconds With, and this time it's Stephen Blank; Martin Lodge Clock, a timepiece commemorating the bond between the armed forces and Freemasons; and the interview this time is the Chief Executive of the Masonic Charitable Foundation, David Innes. A daily advancement section comes next, and it has QC writes, "The Quatuor Coronati community has thrived online despite the lockdown. Notes on a scandal, how William V, Lord Byron, brought about a decline in English Freemasonry. On the side, the Order of the Secret Monitor, ancient origins frame the principles of brotherly care and friendship. And the Museum of Freemasonry, a Bible and travelling warrant tell the story of an 18th century lodge in the military. And 2020 Prestonian Lecture, this year's signature lecture, was delivered to a global audience by Professor Boyes Stones." In the Grand Lodge section, we have quarterly communication. The Grand Master, His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent, on the strength of our spirit and values. Royal Arch, tracing the influence of Lawrence Dermot, whose ideas in the 1750s are followed today. Museum section, with new software, the museum is able to safeguard our digital memories. And learning and development, Solomon is expanding with new sound recordings, videos and interactive content. Then the culture section has the book reviews, and then the Freemasons charity support in times of crisis, how the MCF is providing grants and support to help during the pandemic, and finally your letters.
On page 3, from the Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E. There is a lot of talk in business circles about the benefits of disruptors, people or events which bring about a re-examination of how and why things are done in this particular way or that. It cannot be denied that COVID-19 has been perhaps the biggest disruptor since the invention of the internet. For those that can, many people are finding that they work rather well from home, and are wondering why they ever fought their way into work on packed buses, trains or tube trains when they might have had an extra hour or two in bed instead. Similarly, in the Masonic world, things which traditionally have taken decades or even longer have been created in a couple of weeks. How could we alter our ceremonies to incorporate social distancing? Asks the pro Grand Master. We can't, comes the reply. Try again, he says. Some months previously, the mere suggestion would have had monocles dropping into the soup in abject horror. Is the result to everybody's liking? For certain, no, but it allows the masters and principals of lodges and chapters to choose for themselves what they are comfortable with doing, and what they might wish not to do until things can return to normal, and make no mistake, that may be some significant time yet. Over the summer, Masonic halls have seen a marked increase in emergency meetings, but the real work and the real challenge begins this autumn as the new season begins. Sadly, we will all have come across those brethren who cannot contemplate the possibility that a lodge, their lodge, might meet without them, that Freemasonry may, out of necessity, continue in a different way to that which has gone before, at least for the moment. Those that feel that because their personal circumstances mean they cannot yet return to us, or they choose to stay home, that everything should be put on hold. Lodges can sometimes be dominated by such personalities, and perhaps the disruption of the status quo will remind us that our lodges and chapters are there for all their members, not just those few with the most strident opinions and the loudest voices. Members will need to be flexible and tolerant over the coming few months. Another great change that has come out of this disruption is the way provinces are working together to roll out national initiatives through the COVID Community Fund, a joint UGLE-MCF partnership. To date, it has delivered more than 300,000 meals to the vulnerable, donated 380 tons of food to food banks, provided tens of thousands of pieces of PPE to care homes and hospitals, supported hundreds of young carers, the homeless, women's refuges up and down the country, and donated more than 1,000 tablets to allow relatives to meet virtually at times when visiting was so restricted. Our efforts have not gone unnoticed by the press, and speaking openly about what we are doing has, for the first time, brought about a real change in attitude, even from those who have traditionally been our most dogged detractors. It is worth also reflecting on all the little things we have been doing that have perhaps gone unnoticed. They are just as important, and perhaps more so, than headline-grabbing initiatives. There are many things we have found the time to do that have a small effect on those around us, as well as perhaps those who we have not seen for some considerable time. The small acts of contact and of kindness. The checking in on a brother or their family to make sure that all remains well. The expansion of online communications to keep members in touch and to rekindle sometimes neglected friendships. Some say that we are extremely fortunate that COVID-19 hit in a time where keeping in touch is so easy. Those enduring the Spanish flu in 1918 did not have the luxury of broadband internet with email or Zoom. Most would not even have had access to a telephone. We are mindful, however, that a few of our members have no access to technology, and it is for them that UGLE has just published a guide to help all of our members connect. It is being sent in hard copy format to all provincial communications officers, so please do ask for one if this might be of use to you. Anybody that has mastered elements of Masonic ritual will have no problems navigating the digital world if they are only able to overcome their nervousness. Both of my parents, in their late 80s, are on email and picked it up more easily than they anticipated. Let us all return to the new normal gladly. We are all looking forward to joining together again to continue our Masonic journeys, even if our path might be more winding and unfamiliar than usual. Companions and brethren, it's good to be back. I wish you the very best for the new season. Dr. David Staples, Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E.
Page 6 begins the Out and About section, a roundup of what's happening in the world of Freemasonry. And the first article is entitled Raising a Glass, and then we'll get on to the news from around the provinces. Raising a Glass. At a time when lodge meetings can't happen, the hashtag Time to Toast campaign is keeping the UGLE community in touch online with moving and heartfelt messages of support. As COVID-19 began to spread across Britain, Brian Durrant became concerned about what it would mean for Freemasonry. A Freemason for 22 years and living in the Hampshire and Isle of Wight province, Brian worried about Freemasons who might become isolated during lockdown, as well as the many who would be vulnerable to the virus. When the pandemic started, I could see things going pear-shaped and that a lot of Freemasons would lose contact with each other, says Brian from his home on the south coast. Freemasonry is a massive part of many men's social life. I also worried that we would lose a lot of brethren through this. The solution was to set up a virtual 9 p.m. toast. Hashtag time to toast encouraged brethren to record 2-minute video toasts to absent friends to be posted on social media, Facebook and Twitter, starting with his own toast on the 17th of March. The videos would allow brethren to salute their self-isolating friends and pay respect to any who'd passed away. At first, Brian thought interest would be limited to local Freemasons, but the initiative spread rapidly across the UK and then abroad into countries such as Spain, Cyprus, Chile and the USA. Brian started to get so many requests from brethren wanting him to post their videos, he needed a team of 8 to help organise upcoming toasts using a spreadsheet. Toasts were booked in advance and held at 9 a.m. as well as 9 p.m. to fit everybody in. That's before you even consider the international time zones, which Brian admits can have certain advantages. The other day, I got up at 2 a.m. to talk to some brethren in Massachusetts on Zoom, Brian laughs. They all had a glass in their hand, so that was a good excuse to pour myself a whiskey at that time in the morning. It wasn't a lodge meeting, it was just us all chatting about our lives, Freemasonry and how we're dealing with COVID-19. It was lovely to talk to them. The power of social media is incredible. With UGLE on board and the creation of hashtag time to toast, these 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. toasts became an online phenomenon, spreading rapidly across a variety of social media platforms. We want everyone to raise a glass to those we cannot be with in person due to the huge challenges facing the country, says Dr. David Staples, who joined in with the campaign. Stay safe, self-isolate, but know that you're not alone. We're all unable to do those things we previously took for granted that are so precious to us, meeting with friends at the pub or for a coffee, enjoying each other's company. Being social, in its small way, is something we can still all share. We invite everyone to raise a glass to help raise spirits. Brian admits he is a sociable Freemason and would ordinarily attend 2 or 3 Masonic events a week. Hashtag time to toast has filled some of that space and, with his new international contacts, even expanded his social and Masonic circle. As Lodge Almoner, a motivation for Brian at the start, was concerned that a lack of regular meetings would have a negative impact on Lodge funds at a time when they would be needed more than ever. To counteract that, he has encouraged participating Freemasons to donate the money they would usually spend on dinner and raffle tickets. When I posted toasts on Facebook, I would explain who the brother was, his lodge and his chosen charity. I'd then ask people to leave comments about what they were doing that day, he says. For my toast, I explained that I was dedicating my dining fee and raffle money to the lodge charity fund, and I have done that every month. Losing brethren to COVID-19 will mean the Almoner's fund will get stretched quite quickly. We've lost 4 brethren from one of my lodges alone. For Brian, this has been an unexpected and rewarding undertaking at a difficult time. He has been moved by the messages that his brethren have recorded and that so many remain eager to retain the human contact that Freemasonry provides. Standing up and recording a 2-minute video can be a nerve-wracking experience, he said. Some people told me they had to do it 20 times before they got it right. But they all spoke from the heart about how they were missing their brethren. Some talked about brethren they had lost. It's been incredible, really. Well, now we come to the out and about around the provinces, starting with Berkshire in a moment. This is a spotlight on COVID-19 about how UGLE is celebrating community in the face of adversity.
Number 1. Berkshire. Close contact. Berkshire Freemasons have donated £1,200 to Reading MenCap to help with the issues it is facing due to COVID-19, which has closed its clubs and ME support services. In total, more than £25,000 has gone to local charities throughout Berkshire who are helping the elderly and vulnerable during the crisis. In addition, they have given 25 tablets to local care homes to enable patients to speak with loved ones. The closure of the ME facilities has led to anxiety among users who do not fully understand the current problems or why they must stay at home. To overcome this, the charity is using the grant to deliver activity packs to more than 80 people. "We are helping people to stay occupied and positive so their mental health doesn't suffer," says Marie-Claire Dillian, fundraising manager at Reading MenCap.
Number 2, Bristol. Sky's the limit. The Provincial Grand Lodge of Bristol's Provincial Grand Master Richard Lewis is asking for support for the Great Western Air Ambulance charity during the crisis. "Having volunteered for GWAAC, I see how much your support and generosity means to the charity and the community it serves," says Richard. "Many people don't realise that it is a charity. It receives no money from the government or the National Lottery, and yet requires £4 million per year to provide life-saving services every day of the year. The charity is glad that it's able to support its NHS colleagues and tackle this virus together. The critical care team continue to adapt to this changing environment and deliver the best care. As well as having a critical care team to attend emergency call-outs, GWAAC is supporting the NHS by providing specialist paramedics to assist with transferring intensive care COVID-19 patients requiring advanced respiratory support and supporting other frontline workers with the trauma advice line. To donate, visit www.greatwesternairambulance.com/donate/.
Number 3. Buckinghamshire. Pi hopes. Members of Buckinghamshire Motorcycle Lodge, Colin O'Dell and Brian Neighbour, continued Buckinghamshire Freemasons' efforts to support local communities by delivering pre-cooked cottage pies to 5 sheltered housing schemes. The pies were hygienically prepared and packed by Philip Munday and his team at the Bell Hotel, Winslow. More than 200 pies were delivered in the first batch, and there are plans for further deliveries to vulnerable people. Buckinghamshire Freemasons are proud to be able to help.
Number 4 is Cambridgeshire. Scrubs up well. Much-needed hospital scrubs will be made by volunteers from Connection Through Crafting and paid for by grants from Cambridgeshire Freemasons. The £8,000 in grants will help produce 2,000 sets of scrubs for Addenbrookes, Papworth and other local hospitals and nursing homes. Cambridge wellbeing researcher and seamstress Tricia Sutton is the founder of Connection Through Crafting and has marshalled a growing team of more than 606 members. The group supports the well-being of its members while helping hospital and care home staff get the scrubs they need. To date, Tricia and her group have produced 540 sets of scrubs and 2,500 scrub bags to enable transportation of dirty scrubs.
Number 5. Cheshire. School days. As the strangest school term comes to an end, staff, governors, parents and pupils from St Martin's Academy in Chester can look back in the knowledge they have been able to get all pupils back to full-time education thanks to Cheshire Freemasons offering their hall as a pop-up school. "As the lockdown eased, we planned to bring different year groups in on different days to adhere to the social distancing guidance," says the school's head, Wenda Smith. "We became aware of a kind offer to use the facility at Cheshire View. I visited the venue and immediately said yes. The newly refurbished Freemasons Hall gave us the space we needed to offer all pupils the chance to return to school."
Number 6 next is Cornwall. In April, Cornish Freemasons were asked to donate initiatives related to COVID-19 for support. The Hale Community Kitchen was the first to be nominated and has received a donation of £3,675 to fund them through the coming weeks. Provincial Grand Master Stephen Pern said, working with Disability Cornwall, DIAL, Hale Rugby Club and private Hale businesses to support vulnerable people having to self-isolate or shield is inspiring. We are delighted to support the community of West Cornwall.
Number 7. Cumberland and Westmorland. Atlantic effort. Members of St. Michael's Lodge in Carlisle and former soldier Lance Corporal Mark Harding are raising funds for the frontline workers of the NHS and ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, who helped Mark through rehab after he was shot and paralysed from the neck down while on duty in Afghanistan. The total stands at £3,200. Mark raises funds for the organisations and charities who continue to help him and injured comrades through a series of extreme events around the UK called Challenge Mark. The pandemic compelled Mark to support the NHS as well. He set himself a challenge to row the distance of the Atlantic Ocean on his kayak in his garden. He rowed 100 miles per day and completed his challenge on the 28th of May, the 10th anniversary of his operational injury. The row is in memory of his friends, Kingsman Ponipate Tangitangi Nimothe and Corporal Taniela Tolevu.
And now number 8 is Derbyshire. Derbyshire Freemasons are supporting hospitals, medical centres, pharmacies and the local police by donating PPE. More than 76 organisations have received much-needed deliveries of gloves, face masks and hand sanitiser. Soon, disposable aprons will be added to the list. PPE has been donated by members or purchased using funds from the Derbyshire Freemasons Provincial Grand Charity Fund. Some members have started manufacturing face visors using 3D printers, while individual lodges have also made substantial donations to the cause. Deliveries are being made by volunteers from the Derbyshire Freemasons Motorcycle Lodge by way of a central distribution point at Belper Masonic Hall.
Number 9. Devonshire. Food service. Local people living in food poverty will continue to receive fresh produce from the Plimpton Team Ministry Food Bank, thanks to a £1,500 grant from Devonshire Freemasons. Activity at the food bank has grown rapidly after it opened in April, with the volunteer group at Plimpton Team Ministry having supplied food for more than 100 people. Among those who will benefit are the most vulnerable in the local Plimpton community. And the food bank is getting referrals from schools, charities such as Barnardo's and Homestart, church ministers and doctors' surgeries. Phil Smith, Church Warden and Food Bank Coordinator at the Plimpton Food Bank, said, "We are very grateful to Devonshire Freemasons for their generous donation to help us maintain the supply of food to those in need, and also build up the stock of food in readiness for an expected increase in unemployment."
Number 10. Dorset. Recently established, the Dorset Freemasons COVID-19 Committee, DFCC, has distributed £6,696.90 in support to individuals and groups in Dorset, all working hard to make a difference in these difficult times. As well as helping local groups, such as St Edward's School and West Dorset Scrubbers, make PPE, they've also supplied meals to the Veterans Hub, Hope for Food Bournemouth, and more.
Number 11. Durham. Boxing Clever. Local people in crisis in and around Billingham and Stockton are to benefit from a COVID-19 support grant of £6,000 from Durham Freemasons to Billingham and Stockton Borough Food Bank. Provincial Grand Secretary Tom Gittins went along to Billingham to hand over the grant, where he was met by manager Jill Coyle, who said, "Your donation will enable us to restock and will fund approximately 133 three-day nutritionally balanced family food boxes. Thank you, Durham Freemasons."
Now moving on to Essex. Facing forward, the Essex Provincial Grand Almoner's Appeal started with a £10,000 grant from the Essex Freemasons Community Fund before Essex lodges, chapters and individual brethren added an almost £40,000 more to help towards supporting brethren in financial crisis. Among the brethren helping out were Paul McGuinness of Sibelius Lodge number 9448 and his cousin Lee McGuinness. They produced thousands of headbands on their 3D printers, which were delivered by fellow lodge members Steve Drury and Jack Saunders. Supported by a further £30,000 in grants from the Essex Freemasons Community Fund, Assistant Provincial Grandmaster Lee Taylor coordinated the procurement and supply of facial visors and PPE urgently required in care homes, NHS hospitals, coronavirus wards and community nurse teams across Essex.
Number 13. Gloucestershire. Touching base. Light Blue Clubs and New and Young Masons Clubs across England and Wales have reached out to provide support to the almoners in their province, finding ways of engaging people in these difficult times. Prawsome Semper, Gloucestershire's Light Blue Club, are doing the same. They teamed up with the Sarson Club, Wiltshire New and Young Mason Club, and Essex Cornerstone Club, Essex New and Young Masons Club, to promote connectivity throughout the country through social media at Prawsome_Semper. Together, they created a New and Young virtual social using Zoom and succeeded in getting 40 brethren from Prawsome, Sarson and Essex Cornerstone to participate and raise a glass in a hashtag time to toast to absent brethren. They are now hoping to grow this initiative in size and reach.
Now for number 14, we go a bit further afield to Guernsey and Alderney. Caring Caller. Provincial Grand Master of Guernsey and Alderney Keith Reid, Provincial Charities Steward Jim English and Provincial Communications Officer Tony Letizier met with representatives of St John Ambulance at their headquarters on the 9th of June to present a welcome donation to help it during the early stages of the COVID-19 crisis. The funds will help launch the Caring Caller scheme for people who feel isolated or lonely, as well as coordinate community volunteer efforts.
Number 15. Hampshire and Isle of Wight. Creating a buzz. The Honeypot Children's Charity in Hampshire has received £8,000 from the Freemasons as it moves towards resuming respite breaks for young carers. Due to the pandemic, the charity was forced to halt its crucial residential breaks for children aged between 5 and 12. Launched in March, its emergency action plan attracted many donations, enabling it to continue supporting young carers with an online service. While preparations are underway to resume breaks at Honeypot House in the New Forest, the charity will be aiming to make its 7 acres of recreational land as special as the young carers remember. The donation from Freemasons in the Southampton area will help Honeypot to continue its services.
We're up to number 16 now, and this is Herefordshire. Home Front. Herefordshire Freemasons have donated £1,000 to help the Venture Street Pastors in their work with distressed individuals on the nighttime streets of Hereford. Venture relies on grants and donations and, as with many voluntary organisations, a significant number of their funding streams have dried up. Carol Williams of Venture says, as Venture staff and volunteers seek to work alongside the vulnerable and often poverty-stricken, the kindness of the Herefordshire Masonic Charity Association warms our hearts and encourages us to continue.
Number 17. Hertfordshire. Defying all odds. For any age group, to contract COVID-19 is a frightening prospect. But at over 100 years old, that was the terrifying situation Roy Claridge from the Hertfordshire province was faced with. In early May, Roy had an operation to repair a broken femur. A couple of weeks later, he was able to walk with a frame and was allowed home. But 5 days later, he began to suffer a loss of appetite and stomach pains. He was readmitted to Bedford Hospital, where he tested positive for COVID-19. He was stabilised, but some weeks later still tested positive. Thankfully, by the middle of June, the day before his 102nd birthday, he tested negative and was allowed home. A care package was set up, and Roy continues to make progress. He needs to build his strength up, but remains upbeat. Reciting the ritual has helped, he says. Roy is well known in the province of Hertfordshire. He was initiated into Chipping Barnet Lodge No. 5599 in 1963, and was a founder member of the Hertfordshire Provincial Grand Steward's Lodge No. 8984, having served as a provincial grand steward in 1979.
Across the water again, now to the Isle of Man. King William's Lodge No. 3883 met on the 31st of July for its first regular meeting since the lockdown was introduced, and was the first lodge on the Isle of Man to do so. As the island has been COVID-19 free for over 10 weeks, all restrictions with regard to meetings have been removed.
Number 19. East Kent. Raising relief. The head of East Kent Freemasons, Neil Johnston, is releasing £57,000 from his Disaster Relief Fund as part of the Cornwallis East Kent Freemasons charity. The money will help food banks, local charities and other good causes in East Kent as part of the COVID-19 relief effort. The fund has only been used twice since 1998. First, when the Kent Air Ambulance crashed, and in 2000 when Folkestone had severe flooding. Neil said, "This will enable us to bring relief to those in need in these challenging times." Mark Bassant of the Cornwallis Charity said, "Our members are helping local communities, from assisting the NHS to delivering food to those who cannot get out."
From East Kent to West Kent now, the Provincial Grand Master of West Kent, Mark Esto, has launched the West Kent Emergency Fund, WKEF, to the tune of £100,000. The fund was discussed on the 30th of March and established within a week. Funds have gone towards the manufacture of protective kit to keep key workers healthy, supporting volunteers, helping hospitals and hospices, supporting care in the community, finding food banks, and more.
Number 21. East Lancashire. Keep cooking. Bury District Freemasons have cooked and delivered more than 6,000 free meals to the most vulnerable members of the local community. They are determined to continue doing so until all recipients are able to get regular meals. Their efforts were assisted by generous donations from Roe Hankins Limited and the East Lancashire Masonic Charity. The project also received generous donations of ingredients from Vic Graham Potatoes and Better Veg.
Number 22, West Lancashire next. Jim Corcoran of the Lodge of Harmony No. 220 in the Woolton and Garston Group of West Lancashire Freemasons had been planning to auction, raffle or sell sporting memorabilia at a fundraising event at Liverpool FC's stadium in May to benefit the Masonic Charitable Foundation. When the event was cancelled, Jim realised that some of the memorabilia would be outdated by the time the rearranged function takes place next year. So, Jim had a change of plan. For some years, he had been helping Suzanne Parks, who told him about her new scheme to make PPE for local hospitals, hospices, and medical centres. Having auctioned some of his collection online, Jim decided to donate the rest to the scheme so they could raise enough funds to start making the equipment. Jim raised £2,800 and production started with 11 voluntary machinists who named themselves the Runcorn Sews Scrubs. Local suppliers donated cloth and Parker received a grant from the West Lancashire Freemasons charity that let her recruit 75 women who worked at home making 450 sets of scrubs and scrub caps, scrub bags and 50 theatre gowns, many of which were inscribed with West Lancashire Freemason or Liverpool FC.
Number 23. Leicestershire and Rutland. Superfood. Nurses, doctors and paramedics are receiving home-cooked, pre-packed meals thanks to local Freemason Paul Leary and his wife Alison, plus a grant from Leicestershire and Rutland Freemasons. Paul and Alison run Access Catering based in Leicestershire. They are the resident caterers at Syston Masonic Hall and have been providing meals for nurses and other NHS frontline workers at the three main Leicestershire hospitals. The head of Leicestershire and Rutland Freemasons, Peter Kinder, was so impressed with their efforts, an emergency grant of £3,000 was made to keep them supplied with ingredients. Helen Tum, extended scope of practice physiotherapist, said, "Our staff think it's Christmas when the meals arrive. They are working up to 14 hours a day and have no time to shop or cook. It is a wonderful gesture from the Freemasons.
Next, we have number 24, Lincolnshire. With more than 2,000 meals prepared for people isolated and vulnerable since the start of the COVID-19 crisis, Louth coffee shop owners Mike Bristow, his wife Angie and their son Jamie are thinking about phase two of their Meals on Wheels service. That could mean carrying on with the twice-weekly deliveries until next spring. The family-run Larder's Coffee House in Louth is at the heart of a network supplying meals to Louth, Alford, Spilsby, Horncastle and Skegness, with meals cooked on site and delivered by volunteers. Offering meals is about more than food, says Freemasons Mike and Jamie, who joined Eccles Lodge at Spilsby on the same evening. Lots of the people we help don't have many people to talk to, so the interaction is important to them, and it's rewarding for us. What's more, without the Freemason volunteer delivery drivers, coordinated by Phil Odling, we wouldn't be able to provide food over such a wide area.
Number 25. Middlesex. Open house. The kitchens at the Harrow District and Uxbridge Masonic Centres were reopened during lockdown. With the help of furloughed and volunteer staff, the centres have been preparing pre-packed meals, which are being delivered to the Salvation Army centres at Harlesden, Harrow and Hayes, to the Harrow Voluntary and Community Sector Forum, Soufra, North West London, and to Hillingdon Council for delivery to those in need of a daily meal.
Number 26, Monmouthshire. The province of Monmouthshire has sought ways to help people during the pandemic. Freemasons delivered iPads to the Aneurin Bevin University Health Board, who distributed them across their various hospitals to ensure patients and families could have virtual contact. With families unable to visit loved ones in hospital, a shortage of nightwear for patients had become a real problem. But Monmouthshire Freemasons purchased 70 sets of nightdresses and pyjamas for hospitals across the province. They also continued support for the One Square Meal initiative, which helps vulnerable and elderly people in the Newport area.
Number 27. Norfolk. Put to the test. A machine that can test 2,000 patient samples a day for COVID-19 antibodies will be installed at the University of East Anglia thanks to a grant of £100,000 from the Freemasons. The Dynex Agility Unit analyses blood samples for antibodies to see if a person has had the virus and gained immunity. The test can be used to help formulate a plan on how we might return to our daily lives and to better protect those who remain most vulnerable. The £100,000 donation was raised jointly by Freemasons from Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex and Hertfordshire through the Masonic Charitable Foundation.
Number 28, Northamptonshire and Huntingdonshire. Menu of the day. The House Committee at Palmer Court, Wellingborough, became increasingly concerned that vulnerable residents living in sheltered accommodation were eating less regularly and not able to maintain a well-balanced diet. The committee contacted the chairman of North Ants and Huntingdon's New and Young Masons Club, Dan Cook, for help. Dan and his group of light blues responded immediately and have since been doing a brilliant job of arriving regularly at 5:15 on Mondays and Thursdays to distribute meals, often accompanied by great applause from the residents.
Number 29. Northumberland. Sunday. Freemasons are meeting every Sunday morning in southeast Northumberland to make sure that vulnerable and isolated people are getting a Sunday lunch. Members collect freshly cooked meals from Ashington Masonic Hall and deliver them to those in need. The service is growing, with deliveries around Ashington, Bedlington and Morpeth. Organised by Freemasons Paul Dunning and Jim Grant, the free service was set to run for 13 weeks, but thanks to donations totalling £20,000 from the Province of Northumberland, Northumberland Mark Masons and the Mark Benevolence Fund, the scheme is set to run for many months.
North Wales next, number 30. North Wales Freemasons, through the UGLE's COVID-19 response group, have donated £4,000 to fund the free delivery of Sunday lunch to people living in Bangor and Anglesey. A further £1,000 from A&M Catering helped this local effort. To date, more than 2,200 free lunches have been delivered through this initiative to the community, courtesy of Ernest and Mehdi Wynne Jones at Bangor Masonic Hall.
Number 31. Nottinghamshire. Fighting Fit. The Freemasons of Nottinghamshire moved quickly to support those in the community whose lives were most disrupted by the lockdown. Proposals were drawn up to assist the NHS, the care sector, and local charities. During discussions with the voluntary sector, it became clear that mental welfare services and those supporting victims of abuse were being swamped. Thanks to the generosity of Nottinghamshire Brethren, organisations received financial support, enabling them to continue their aid to the most vulnerable. So far, they have donated over £33,000 to 23 charities. To give them a platform to continue with assistance, Nottinghamshire Freemasons launched an appeal called 75 for 75, their aim being to raise a £75,000 fighting fund from their lodges in 1 week to coincide with the 75th anniversary of VE Day. The amount received was just under £72,000, almost £900 per lodge in the province.
Number 32 next, Shropshire. Shropshire's 1,200 Freemasons have responded to the coronavirus crisis by giving over £60,000 to support charities throughout the province. Individual lodges and chapters, including the Wrekin Lodge, a metropolitan lodge with its roots in Shropshire, and the Shropshire Masonic Charitable Association, provided grants totalling more than £26,000 to make sure that every food bank in the Shropshire Food Poverty Alliance has been supported, as well as nearly £4,000 to make and distribute PPE to 88 care homes. The Masonic Charitable Foundation sent a further £12,500 to support initiatives such as the Shrewsbury Food Hub and the Shropshire Food Poverty Alliance. Salopian Lodge of Charity number 117 has provided £21,000 to enable the Food Hub to buy a van so it can continue its work 7 days a week. Andy McGuinness of Roden Lodge, number 6243, put his 3D printer model-making hobby to good use by making face visors. The Provincial Grand Master, Roger Pemberton, authorised the use of provincial funds to buy another printer, while three more were donated.
Number 33. Somerset. What's Cooking? Ramajo's Community Meals has received a £1,000 boost from Somerset Freemasons. Since lockdown, Ramajo's has produced meals for 150 of the province's most vulnerable people 7 days a week. The team of volunteers organise everything from food preparation to delivery. Meals are free and costs are met by community donations. Food is prepared in the local Butcher's Arms award-winning kitchen, run by Caroline Radnidge and Nick Williams. The pub also provides 140 fruit and veg boxes for the community weekly.
Next we go to South Wales. South Wales Freemasons have donated 3,000 vital PPE visors to more than 100 hospitals, GPs, care homes, hospices, pharmacies, prisons and schools, helping more than 2,400 frontline and key workers throughout the province. Robert Payne, who instigated the initiative, said the visors were sourced from a local company in the Caerphilly Borough, who turned their printing and design company into a manufacturer of PPE visors. The Freemasons of South Wales funded 3,000 units and have distributed them to the organisations and people in the local area who need them most in the fight against COVID-19.
Number 35. Staffordshire. Shower with gifts. Staffordshire Freemasons are allocating 10,000 bottles of shower gel to hospitals providing critical care in the province. The province of Staffordshire sent its thanks to Sarah Thomas, wife of the Deputy Provincial Grand Master David Thomas, for her help. David has made deliveries to hospitals in Leek, Stoke, Stafford County, Walsall, Stafford St George's, Sandwell and Burton. A note on each box says, "Please accept this donation of shower gels for the use of the wonderful staff in your hospital, supplied by Hotel Complimentary Products Limited at cost price and funded by the Staffordshire Freemasons through the Staffordshire Masonic Benevolent Association."
Number 36, and we move to Suffolk now. First defence. Suffolk Light Blues are delivering PPE free of charge to a large number of medical sites working in the front line against COVID-19. Around 100 members of the Light Blues from across the province are making daily deliveries to GP surgeries, hospitals in Ipswich, Cambridge, Colchester and Norwich, as well as care homes across East Anglia. Suffolk Freemasons have donated PPE to Haven Health in Felixstowe, where the team at Howard House are providing dedicated sites for possible COVID-19 patients.
Number 37. Surrey. Safety first. Marlon Oreo is an anaesthetic nurse at Kingston Hospital and the immediate past master of Lawn Lodge No. 1347 in Surrey. His duties at Kingston Hospital have included preparing patients' drugs and airways while assisting anaesthetists, as well as ensuring anaesthetic machines and ventilators work and stay working. "It is a difficult time and we feel particularly vulnerable," says Marlon. "We are in contact with our patients whenever we intubate them. I sometimes need to troubleshoot their life support machines, which increases my risk of infection." Such medical staff need ongoing support and training to be able to do their jobs effectively. Joe Lawrence, Managing Director of Back to Life, is therefore especially thankful to Surrey Freemasons for helping them to deliver this crucial training, with Surbiton Masonic Halls stepping in as an alternative emergency training venue for their advanced life support courses. The Masonic Benevolent Fund has also provided face visors for those training courses.
Now, number 38, Sussex. Meditech Trust was founded by Bob Lewis in 2002 and has donated equipment worth over £1 million to Sussex hospitals, with a further 1.5 million items going to other hospitals in the UK and abroad. Throughout COVID-19, he has concentrated his efforts on sourcing and donating PPE items to hospitals and the care profession. MTT donated 5,000 face shields to East Sussex hospitals in April and another 5,000 2 weeks later. The charity was selected by the Mark Benevolent Fund to distribute their donated reusable face visors to care workers throughout Sussex. Bob has been coordinating with an Eastbourne factory ensuring local people are employed to research and manufacture surgical gowns that can be worn, washed and reused 10 to 12 times. Meditech Trust has donated gowns worth £10,000, with more destined for other Sussex hospitals.
Number 39. West Wales. Take cover. In these challenging times, one of the most difficult things for those in a healthcare environment is separation from loved ones. To help patients stay in touch, the West Wales Grand Charity bought 21 computer tablets at a cost of £1,800, which will be donated to health professionals throughout the province to use in a range of hospital and healthcare settings. The fact that people are unable to visit creates further problems for patients, because their families are unable to bring fresh clothing and toiletries to them. In conjunction with the Howell Dar University Health Board, members of the Mackworth Club for Light Blue Freemasons has developed a scheme to provide new nightwear and underwear to patients in the province who are unable to get these things in the usual way. An initial order has been placed for more than £10,000 to be distributed throughout the province by the Health Board.
Number 40, Wiltshire. Now, Wiltshire Freemasons have been involved in several high-profile initiatives during the COVID-19 crisis. With St Joseph's Roman Catholic School in Salisbury, the Freemasons paid for and delivered more than 4,500 face visors to NHS staff and care home workers in the province. And, led by Corsham Lodge, they teamed up with food expert, chef and Freemason Tom Snell to deliver pre-prepared food boxes to self-isolating members. The initiative that had the most emotional impact, however, was Hearts That Care. At a White Horse Lodge No. 2227 meeting in Westbury, John Morehouse was thinking of how he could show his appreciation for the work of NHS frontline staff while raising money for his local hospitals and Teddy's for Loving Care. He came up with the Hearts That Care. The little hearts are created by John's sister and are made by fusing two pieces of glass, one white, one clear with a paper heart. John funded most of the 350 Hearts That Care, which were donated to frontline NHS staff and care home workers. John has given away more than 500 Hearts That Care and used National Carers Week in June to promote the unsung heroes of the county's care homes, as well as home-based carers.
Number 41. Worcestershire. Road to Recovery. At the end of March, Worcestershire Freemason Steve Holmes wasn't feeling well and was taken into hospital. He describes the devastating toll of the virus. They told me I had viral pneumonia. I tested positive for COVID-19, and this was the start of my real problems, he says. After struggling for a few days with my oxygen levels, they sedated me and put me onto a ventilator, where I remained for 5 weeks. At the end of May, my wife Laura and family were told to prepare for the worst, but I was fighting and, a week later, regained consciousness to the point that I could speak to Laura on the phone. During his recovery, Steve had a stroke and transferred to the stroke clinic in Evesham. Steve says, I still have a lot to do to learn to walk and talk again, but I am making good progress. Page Lodge number 3378 have been amazing and given my family so much support. My thanks go to all my friends, members of my lodge, my family, and above all, the NHS staff who continue to help my recovery. I am looking forward to the life I nearly lost and hopefully going into the chair of Page Lodge next year.
Number 42, Yorkshire and North East. During lockdown, the old Gisborian Lodge, number 7793, hasn't been able to meet. Seeking opportunities to support local charities, members decided to donate their meal money to local good causes, particularly COVID-19 support initiatives. The lodge raised £660, divided between two charities, the Bridge Food Bank in Gisborough, which was set up as a community project by Churches Together in Gisborough, and For the Love of Scrubs at James Cook University Hospital.
Number 43. Yorkshire West. Never Walk Alone. A Huddersfield community charity that supports men with mental health issues is overwhelmed by the financial support from West Riding Masonic Charities. Platform One, based in St George's Square, has received a £10,000 grant as part of the COVID-19 response to assist valuable work in local communities. Men from a range of backgrounds are offered pastoral support by Platform One in situations such as coping with bereavement, housing, personal finance and drug or alcohol addiction. Robert Morse, project leader at Platform One, says, Those familiar with Platform One will know our actions save lives, save sanity, and save spirits. The Freemasons have given us £10,000 to use in our battle for men who cannot fight mental health alone and find themselves in danger both mentally, emotionally, and physically, with nowhere to go and no hope. The Masons do what they do because they care about their fellow man, and this money will impact upon the outcomes of many men. Provincial Grand Master David Pratt says, There is a heightened awareness of the mental impact on well-being, and we are delighted to provide a donation of £10,000 from our members, who include those from 15 Huddersfield area lodges.
Number 44, Warwickshire next. The Warwickshire Masonic Benevolent Fund is donating £68,450 to hospitals, hospices, charities, food banks and companies making 3D printed face masks across the province. In addition, they've donated 150 tablets to University Hospital Trust, letting isolated patients keep in touch with families.
Number 45, Metropolitan. Rapid response. London Freemasons have been proactive in assisting those in need throughout the pandemic. Assistant Metropolitan Grand Master Andrew Manassa assembled a London COVID-19 Response Group, LCRG, to seek out and implement London initiatives. These include £10,000 for the Felix Project Food Bank, a registered charity that rescues high-quality surplus food and delivers it to emergency food hubs, food banks, homeless shelters, local charities, churches, schools, and hospitals. £10,000 to City Harvest London. This registered charity delivers high-quality, nourishing food to organisations that provide meals to vulnerable people. To date, they've delivered £10 million worth of food. That's 80 million meals. £33,000 to manufacture and deliver over 36,000 medical visors to London hospitals, not-for-profit care homes and hospices. £20,000 to buy 115 Samsung Galaxy tablets for the ICUs of 24 London hospitals for patients to communicate with relatives. £25,000 grant for meals to be cooked and delivered to vulnerable and disadvantaged people from the West London Masonic Centre in Ealing. Brethren at the WLMC are cooking 800 meals per week.
And finally, in this roundup of the provinces, two districts overseas. First, the District Grand Lodge of Jamaica and the Cayman Islands. Harmony Lodge, with the Hanover Lay Magistrates and Hopewell Kiwanis, donated masks and sanitizers to the Jamaica Constabulary Force in Hanover at the Parish HQ. A similar donation will be made to the Hanover Fire Brigade. And there's a picture accompanying the article showing members of Hanover Police and a member of Hanover Lay Magistrates with Worshipful Master Horace Morrison, Aston King, Wilston Taylor Jr. and Calvin McIntyre.
District Grand Lodge of Madras. Donate a monthly dinner is an idea mooted by the St. John's Lodge No. 434 at Secunderabad. Members' money, otherwise spent on the festive board meal after a Masonic meeting, is donated while meetings are not taking place to provide groceries to underprivileged people.
The next article in this Out and About section is In Memoriam to Absent Brethren. We look back at the life of a provincial grandmaster, Right Worshipful Brother Rodney Lister Bass, OBE, a long-serving Freemason whose contribution to the wider Masonic family will be a lasting legacy. UGLE pays its final respects to Right Worshipful Brother Rodney Lister Bass, OBE, who died aged 74 on the 14th of July after a long battle with lung cancer. He had been Provincial Grand Master of Essex since September 2015, following a distinguished career in banking and local government. Rodney was a senior manager at HSBC, and his deep belief in service to the community led to him following in his father's footsteps and joining Maldon Rural Council, later Maldon Council, in 1967. He was the youngest councillor in the country at that time. He worked for the council for the next 40 years, and in 1997 he also became an Essex County Councillor, going on to becoming a Cabinet Member for Highways and Transportation 2003 to 2007, Vice Chairman of Essex County Council 2008 to 2009, and County Council Chairman 2010 to 2012. Rodney then served again as Cabinet Member for Highways and Transportation between 2013 and 2015 and oversaw some of the Council's largest capital projects, pushing for investment and improvement in the county's roads. He then focused on infrastructure until 2016, retiring after 50 years of public service in 2017. In recognition of his service to the community, he was elected an Honorary Alderman of Essex and honoured by Her Majesty the Queen in October 2017 when she invested him as an Officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, the OBE. Rodney was initiated into Tollesbury Lodge No. 4738 in October 1978 and exalted into Tollesbury Chapter in October 1981. Rodney was the Master of Tollesbury Lodge in 1992 and the MEZ of Tollesbury Chapter in 2002. His appointment as a Provincial Grand Steward in the Craft followed in 1994 and in the Royal Arch in 2003. He was appointed to Craft Grand Rank in 2010 and as an APGM in the year 2011. In 2015, he was invested as the Right Worshipful Provincial Grand Master for and the Grand Superintendent in and over Essex. He had also been the Master of Woodrolf Lodge No. 8354 in 2006 and the MEZ of Clapton Chapter, Met GL, in 2008. He went on to be Master of the Bear and Ragged Staff Lodge No. 8527 in 2015, Essex Masters Lodge No. 3256 in 2016, Essex Provincial Grand Stewards Lodge No. 8665 in 2019, the MEZ of Clapton chapter for the second and third time in 2015 and 2018, the MEZ of Essex First Principles chapter number 3256 in 2018, and Essex Provincial Grand Stewards chapter in 2019. Rodney was passionate about Tollesbury, his mother lodge, where he continued to play an active role and where the whole executive dropped in unexpectedly in 2018 to help him celebrate his 40th anniversary as a Freemason. He also joined several lodges and chapters over the years and was made an honorary member of many others across the province. Under his leadership, his executive became more open and approachable, and Essex Freemasons were encouraged to increase their community involvement, starting with an appeal that raised £160,000 to build a high wire and zip wire facility for Essex Scouts at Screens Park, Chelmsford. His launch of a new Essex Freemasons Community Fund in 2019 has made significant funds available to help hundreds of local charities and good causes across the county. At the time of his appointment as PGM, Provincial Grandmaster, Freemasonry was shrinking nationally. In the 5 years before his appointment, the craft in Essex lost 1,431 members, 13.6% drop, that is, while the Royal Arch lost 423 members, that's 10.7% drop. In 5 years that he held office, the craft losses were reduced to 783, that's 8.6% drop, and the Royal Arch 152, 4.3% drop. Rodney was a great supporter of the other Masonic orders and was an active member of many of them, including Mark, Royal Arch Mariners, Rosicrucians, Knights Templar, Royal Order of Scotland, Royal and Select Masters, and the Commemorative Order of Thomas of Acon. Paul Reeves, Deputy Provincial Grand Master in charge, says Rodney Bass was a great man who was loved and respected by everyone who knew him. Essex Freemasonry will be the poorer for his passing. Since his appointment in 2015, he has transformed Freemasonry in Essex, instilling a spirit of openness and ensuring that members strived to make a difference in their communities. He worked hard to forge greater links and cooperation with all of the additional orders, and his contribution to the wider Masonic family will be a lasting legacy. In April 2019, Rodney was diagnosed with lung cancer, but it didn't slow his commitment to Essex and Freemasonry, a commitment that was only cut short by the sudden deterioration of his condition. Rodney leaves his wife, Margaret, and stepchildren, Emilio and Lydia. Brother, worshipful brother Henry Bass, and sister Julia Peel. He was predeceased by his elder sister Alison Gould. On Wednesday the 29th of July, Rodney Lister Bass, OBE, was laid to rest. Later that day, more than 1,000 Essex Masons across the province joined various Zoom meetings hosted by the Essex Provincial Executive to show their respect and to join in a 9 o'clock toast to absent brethren and departed merit.
On page 18, a legacy to be proud of. As Mike Wilkes bows out as head of Hampshire and Isle of Wight Freemasons, let us introduce you to his successor, John Whittaker. The Provincial Grand Master of the Freemasons in the province of Hampshire and Isle of Wight has retired from the role after a decade of achievements. Mike Wilkes is succeeded by John Whittaker, a long-standing magistrate, senior St. John Ambulance volunteer, COVID-19 NHS responder, and a volunteer with ex-services charities. The HR consultant from Hamble, near Southampton, has pledged to build on the legacy of his predecessor. Under Mike Wilkes' tenure, the province, which includes Bournemouth and Christchurch, became one of the most forward-thinking in the country, leading many new initiatives. For one special fundraising effort during his time as Provincial Grand Master, Mike led his members in raising close to £8 million for a children's charity. This was in addition to the existing charitable commitments by members and lodgers. Another legacy is the number of special interest lodges that have been formed around the province during the past 10 years, such as football, rugby, sailing, aviation, and motorsport lodges. Mike says, It has been an enormous privilege to serve as Provincial Grand Master, and I've had wonderful support. We have seen our membership develop and have many younger new members. In handing over to John, I know what great hands the province is in, and I hope it's not too long before our lodges are able to start meeting again following the coronavirus crisis. John says, "Having been Mike's deputy and worked closely with him, I know how he has transformed the province, so it is now the largest in the country. I want to build on his legacy and to see Freemasonry flourish, especially across Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. First, I'll be encouraging our members to continue to do all they can in responding to the coronavirus crisis." The province of Hampshire came into being in 1767 when Thomas Dunkerley, the reputed natural son of George II, was appointed Provincial Grand Master. He was followed by Lord Charles Montague, while other notable occupants of the office include Sir William Champion de Crespigny, MP, the Earl of Yarborough, and Edward Harris, the Right Honourable the 5th Earl Malmesbury. The Isle of Wight became part of the province in 1869.
Page 21 starts the stories section, people, places, history and more. And there are four stories in this section. First of all, the gin distiller making hand sanitizer for people in need. Then 60 seconds with the Provincial Grand Master of Cheshire, Stephen Blank. Then commemorative clock tells the story of shared values. And finally, the David Innes interview, the Chief Executive of the MCF discusses his work with the charity. So here's the first of those four. This one's The Spirit of Freemasonry. When the COVID-19 pandemic stopped production at his gin distillery, Matt Felgate turned his skills to making much-needed hand sanitizer for his community instead. When COVID-19 struck the UK and we were advised to isolate, I tried to buy hand sanitizer for my mother, who was shielding following a kidney transplant, said Max Felgate. She has no immune system, and I was worried about her catching the virus. I struggled to find any hand sanitizer that I didn't need to take out a mortgage on to buy. When friends suggested to Matt that his mum should consider self-isolating at the gin distillery he runs, they rightly said no germs could survive with all that alcohol I had. It proved to be Matt's eureka moment. Researching which ingredients were needed to make medical-grade sanitizer, Matt found that he already had most of them to hand. With 90% of my stockists closed because of lockdown, I put the high-strength alcohol destined for our gin to what I felt was better use, hand sanitizer. Sticking to the World Health Organization, the WHO, formula, Matt and his father-in-law, John, began making batches of hand sanitizer for friends, family and vulnerable neighbours. Before establishing the Lincoln Distillery, Matt, a member of St Hugh Lodge No. 1386, had served in the military, after which he quite liked the idea of running a pub, unquote. His wife, Jen, meanwhile fancied managing a B&B. While checking out the market, the couple heard about a tea room on Lincoln's famous steep hill. The owners were retiring and it was about to become available. It felt like a good compromise, remembers Matt. The couple opened Bunty's Tea Room in September 2012, giving it a vintage, nostalgic theme with real china crockery and massive homemade cakes with quirky flavours. Bunty's was soon a huge hit. As Matt recounts, there were queues at the door every day, and the tea room even earned a number one slot on TripAdvisor. It was while running the tea room that Matt started to dabble with distilling. "The business was doing well, and I began to think of ways of expanding it," he said. "I wanted a premium product that we could make, which had a longer shelf life, and one we could offer for delivery by post." Seated at an airport bar, Matt realised what that product was to be. "The bar had a small built-in distillery," says Matt. "I spoke to the distiller, sampled one or two of his gins, and was fascinated by the copper apparatus and the whole alchemy involved in the process." Matt invested in his own kit, which cost around the same as the espresso machine at work, and taught himself the art of gin making. It took me a couple of years to learn how to distill. I began to wish I hadn't dropped A-level chemistry, and to get the necessary licenses. Matt also visited other distilleries, met with distillers, and worked on developing his recipes and thinking of a name for his own gin. Jen and Matt sold Bunty's in May 2019, a week after their son was born. "That was a horrible week," says Matt. "My son had sepsis and suspected meningitis and was rushed to intensive care. He nearly didn't make it. A big thank you to the NHS and Rotherham Special Baby Care Unit." Matt found himself unemployed and decided to turn his hobby into a business. The Lincoln Distillery, the city's first commercial distillery to open since the 1860s, was born. Less than a year later, of course, COVID-19 struck and the business underwent its major metamorphosis, with Matt putting aside botanicals to become a temporary science boffin. The process of switching from gin to hand sanitizer was, he says, relatively straightforward. "It helped that I was used to working with and had permissions to acquire restricted substances. To have an effect on the virus, Matt had to ensure the sanitizer had an alcohol content above 60% ABV, as well as source new plastic bottles, containers and labels. We closed down the distillery side of things and adapted the workstations," he said. "We also made the distillery safe for us with social distancing, sanitizer and hand washing stations, no public access and so on." As well as sharing it with family and friends, Matt offered his hand sanitizer to frontline key workers, care homes, the isolated, elderly and vulnerable, and the charities working with them. "We didn't realize just how many were struggling to find sanitizer and whose suppliers had either run out or hiked the prices up," Matt remembers. Word spread and the distillery was inundated with orders. Matt's story even reached Japan, where it was picked up by news site Asahi Digital. "Matt refused to take any payment for his hand sanitizer. It didn't sit right with me to capitalize on people's fears and desperation," he said. "In my eyes, this wasn't a case of supply and demand. It was a national relief effort, and I wanted to do my bit." Instead, he launched Hashtag Community Spirit, a not-for-profit initiative to produce and supply hand sanitizer to frontline key workers, the community, vulnerable and hard-to-reach people in Lincolnshire. "Many of the people who received hand sanitizer from us had offered to pay something towards the cost as a thank you," says Matt. "After refusing to accept money from them, someone suggested that we set up a crowdfunding page for them to donate to instead. We also tried to link up with other distilleries and divide the region into zones for each of us to cover in an attempt to ensure as many folk as possible received help." The vital work Matt has done with his business dovetails brilliantly with Freemasonry values of benevolence, charity and brotherly love. "I saw our work at the distillery as an opportunity to use the working tools at our disposal in a charitable way and help those from all walks of life who required assistance," he said. As well as keeping busy with sanitizer distribution, Matt is now once again producing gin and has been developing new products and working on a website for when things return to some form of normality. "We also have a batch of our cask-aged gin due to be bottled in a couple of weeks." And if you want more information about Matt's work, go to www.thelincolndistillery.co.uk or contact him at matt@thelincolndistillery.co.uk. And Matt has got two T's.
On page 26, Finance, Football and Freemasonry. Meet Stephen Blank, Provincial Grand Master for Cheshire, Member of the Board of General Purposes, Member of the Grand Master's Council, Chairman of the Project Hermes 2B Working Party, and avid Manchester United fan. Once upon a time, Stephen Blank wanted to be a professor of mathematics, but eschewing academia for something more profitable, he wisely embarked on a career in finance instead. "I realized while researching for my MSc that, although I was pretty good at maths, there were some people quite a bit better, and they were going to get the jobs. Furthermore, at 21, we wanted to get married, and I thought two of us starving to death in poverty probably wasn't a good idea. I changed track and qualified as a chartered accountant with KPMG in 1976. I then worked for a specialist insurance company owned by Swiss Re of Zurich. The company started making acquisitions and also bought a Singer System 10, one of the first mini computers. I became part of the project team trying to make it work. I then returned to the profession and became a partner in BDO Binder Hamlin, based at its Manchester office. I pursued my interest in computers, learning VisiCalc on a Commodore PET. I became head of corporate finance and a member of the National Partnership Committee. I was reporting accountant for part of the electricity privatisation and then left to join one of my clients, Swinton Insurance, as group planning and finance director. Swinton was promptly taken over by Royal Sun Alliance, and I left to pursue a portfolio career, acting as an independent director for a small portfolio of small and medium-sized businesses based in the Northwest. At first, part of the portfolio included a part-time FD role, but today it's deliberately much smaller, and my role is non-executive director.
How did you first get involved in Freemasonry?
I became a Freemason in 1976, joining my late father's lodge at Bridge Street in Manchester where I was working. It was a slow burn as Freemasonry goes, partly because it was a big lodge and partly because I was busy with work and family. So it took me 12 years to get to the chair. My first position was as district secretary.
What do you find most inspiring about being a Freemason?
I've been to places and met people I would never have encountered had I not been a Freemason. Some of those happened because I was fortunate enough to become a Deputy Grand Director of Ceremonies, but even before that, I always liked the variety of people that you meet in terms of background and age. Freemasonry gives you the chance to meet people who are not necessarily like you, but who share the same values. It was wonderful to share a lodge with my late father, and now my son-in-law is in my lodge, which is great fun.
Is there a historical Freemason that you find fascinating, and why?
I like the Masonic connections of some of the founding fathers of the USA. I also like the hints of Freemasonry that you see in the early documents. I'm not quite sure what they would make of politics in the USA today.
Do you have a hero in life that you aspire to be like?
It has to be Sir Alex Ferguson. Not just because he was an amazingly successful manager of my football team. I met him on two occasions, and each time he was an inspiration. The first was on a VIP trip to Italia 90 to see England play Germany with the directors of United, one of whom was my golf partner, and Sir Alex. We got on the coach to leave the game, where the police had been unnecessarily aggressive towards the England fans. On our way to the hotel, Sir Alex asked the driver to stop for an England fan who had found himself in an unfriendly area without his friends. He invited him on the coach and asked the driver to take him back to his hotel. The second was a business breakfast where he was the guest speaker. He told us about the manager's traditional approach to coaching, which was to build up a black book of training techniques. He had just bought Eric Cantona and noticed that a few players stayed behind after training. It was unheard of at English clubs in those days. Sir Alex decided to watch and saw that Cantona was leading his own session. At first he was annoyed that anybody felt they could add to what he was coaching, but he realised the value of what Cantona was teaching, so he tore up his little black book and started over. That showed me the importance of humility and an open mind.
What is your favourite hobby?
Watching Manchester United and playing with my grandchildren. I took up golf in my 40s, but Freemasonry and frequent trips to London to see the grandchildren got in the way, so I gave it up about 8 years ago. I have started playing again, and I've got a big game with my son coming up soon. I read a lot, mainly science fiction, but also historical novels.
Is there a place you'd love to travel to?
I have travelled extensively, including Australia, Japan, Thailand, India, Israel, Sri Lanka, the USA, and most of Europe. A trip to New Zealand would be nice, but I have to say I don't enjoy air travel these days. The south of France is my favourite part of the world overseas.
Which book would you recommend?
Martin Gilbert's biography of Churchill. I didn't include Churchill as my inspiration because I couldn't live up to 1% of what he did. But I enjoy reading the story because if you can see the hand of the great architect in anything, it must be Churchill's leadership during the war. He was, of course, a Freemason, but not really practicing, so I didn't nominate him as my fascinating historical Freemason.
Most memorable part of your Freemasonry initiation?
When the blindfold came off and I saw my father in front of me. I knew it was him, but it was still a very special moment. My father was way ahead of his time because, unlike most of his generation, he was open about being a Freemason. He was also a Grand Officer. The charge after initiation was wonderful to hear. I still remember learning that for our Lodge of Instruction.
If you were on Mastermind, what would your specialist subject be?
I was tempted to say Manchester United, but there are many people far more knowledgeable about the club than myself, including my son. I thought about the goals of Mark Hughes during the European Cup Winners' Cup campaign of season 1990-91, because I went to every game, home and away. The only subject I might stand a chance of winning would be the novels of Frank Herbert, my favourite science fiction writer.
Best piece of advice you've ever received that you like to live your life by?
The charge after initiation says it all. The number of times I've heard little bits of it quoted by Freemasons in ordinary conversation or in business tells me what an impression it makes on most Freemasons, and that can't be a bad thing.
Time honoured. The story of the 17th Battalion Hampshire Regiment and Martin Lodge No. 1983 is testament to the bond of brotherhood shared by the armed forces and the Freemasons. At the installation meeting on the 8th of November 1918 at the Third Rising, Brother Captain Edwin Timms of the 17th Battalion Hampshire Regiment and the Duke of Connaught Lodge No. 1834 rose and presented to the newly installed master, Worshipful Brother Andrew J. Critton, a handsome clock in an oak case. The inscription on the clock reads, "Presented to the Martin Lodge 1983, by the 17th Hampshire Regiment, in appreciation of the Masonic friendship extended to them during their stay in Southwold from February 1918 to November 1918. Captain Timms thanked the brethren of Martin Lodge for the kindness shown to them during their stay in Southwold. In turn, the master thanked the brethren of the Hampshire Regiment for their handsome gift and assured Captain Timms that they would always look back on the happy times spent together in the lodge, sincerely hoping that they would see them again. As the war came to an end and those brethren returned to their homes, they were assured that on the sixth day of the week, in the second week of the month at 9:30 p.m, they would be held in remembrance. And, to this day, the brethren of Martin Lodge, No. 1983, and their guests still honour the brethren of the Hampshire Regiment at its November meeting at 9:30 p.m. with a toast to the Hampshire Regiment. The clock still retains its place on the mantelpiece of the lodge's anteroom, where it has been since 1922, when the present lodge was built. On the 9th of November 1918, On the 9th of November 2018, 100 years after its presentation, Martin Lodge held a special meeting to commemorate the centenary of the event and the end of World War I. Service medals and Masonic jewels were worn, the lodge was opened, and the non-Masonic invited guests were admitted into the temple. Cadets and staff of the 1379 Leyston Squadron of the RAFAC paraded their standard into the temple and took their seats. Some of the brethren from the lodge are attached to this unit as instructors. Representing the Hampshire Regiment was Worshipful Brother Doug Chambers of Sir Francis Drake Lodge No. 7668 and a former Regimental Sergeant Major of the 1st Battalion Hampshire Regiment who gave a presentation on the history of the 17th Home Service Battalion of the Hampshire Regiment. The regiment was formed on the 13th of February 1915 at Bishop's Waltham, Hampshire. The regiment was formed on the 13th of February 1915 at Bishop's Waltham, Hampshire. After a month of training, orders were received to proceed to Leith in Scotland, where they were stationed with the Highland Brigade. Their duties were to guard the docks, Granton Harbour, Blackness Castle, the Forth Bridge and Queen's Ferry. In May of 1915, the battalion moved to the northeast coast near Blyth. Here, they carried out similar duties as before. In March of 1916, they were transferred to Herne Bay in Kent, where they remained until October 1917. They were then moved to Whitstable, before finally arriving in Southwold in February 1918. Much work had to be done to repair the defences there, as they'd been extensively damaged and in places washed away by the sea. The hutments and billets were in a dreadful state, and these were restored back to perfect condition by the battalion. After the armistice, the battalion dispersed and was wound up in May 1919. The battalion remained a home service one, and the unit did not see any fighting, although the commanding officer had artillery consisting of 6 18-pounders, 2 4.7-inch guns and 52 Lewis guns under his command. The centenary celebrations then continued, with worshipful brother Steve Bignall giving an explanation of the presentation of the clock and details about the Brethren of the Lodge from that era, along with their connection to the armed services. Martin Lodge's Roll of Honour was read out, as were the names of the present Brethren who had served in the armed forces. The congregation then stood for the reading of the Ode to Remembrance, followed by the Last Post and a two-minute silence. The standard was then paraded out, followed by the worshipful master and grand officers. It is unfortunate that 80% of the records of the Hampshire Regiment were destroyed during the Blitz of World War II. This has meant that the list of those mentioned as belonging to the regiment may be incomplete. There were many members of the services who were stationed in Southwold during this period, who were regular visitors to the lodge, engineers such as Major Grigson, who was from the Prince of Wales Lodge No. 1338 in Auckland. The records for the year of 1918 only go to show what a wonderful organisation we have the privilege of belonging to, and that we were able to practice all those qualities we profess to admire. And there is a picture on the clock commemorating Brethren from the 17th Battalion Hampshire Regiment, the clock presented to the Martin Lodge in 1918. And there's a plaque under this rather splendid ornate clock made of a wooden case with the plaque at the bottom on the plinth.
On page 31, in the service of others. In his time as chief executive of the Masonic Charitable Foundation, the Freemasons' charity, David Innes has given Freemasonry a national voice in the charity sector. He leaves a legacy to be proud of. When David Innes started planning his retirement as chief executive of the Masonic Charitable Foundation, he anticipated a quiet 6 months winding down before handing over to his successor, Les Hutchinson, in the autumn of 2020. What he got was a worldwide pandemic and the sort of national and international crisis that the MCF was designed to help. The first thing we had to do was move overnight to remote working, says Innes. Then we set up an additional grant-making programme of £3.6 million. That was a major undertaking and pretty challenging, but we have already made nearly 200 grants of a wide variety of sizes. It has kept us busy. Put it this way. I have not had a chance to tidy the house and fill bags with things to take to charity shops. Apparently, that all awaits me in retirement. It's difficult to imagine the hard-working Innes having a quiet retirement even when he does step down from the MCF. As chief executive, he was instrumental in creating the charity from the four existing Masonic charities, something that provided Freemasons with a national voice in the charity sector for the first time. He felt very strongly that what was best for Freemasonry was what was best for the Masonic community, says the MCF chair James Newman. Masonic charities and Freemasonry in general owe him a huge debt of gratitude. He has created a charity that Freemasons can be justifiably proud of. Thanks to David, we have a major player that is representative of Freemasonry. Newman first met Innes in 2008, when Innes applied for the position of Chief Executive of the Royal Masonic Benevolent Institute, RMBI. Innes had moved into the charity sector in 2005, before which he had led the international fundraising team at Canterbury Cathedral. Prior to that, he had been in the Royal Engineers, rising to the rank of Brigadier and serving in Northern Ireland and the Balkans during a military career of more than 30 years. Through this military and charity experience, he gained a skill set that he felt complemented the role on offer at the RMBI, where he was responsible for a £47 million business that looked after 1,100 residents in 18 care homes. We realised within a short period of time that we had appointed somebody who could really make a difference as a charity and the way we did things, says Newman. We saw his professional and organisational qualities early on, and we also saw his caring qualities. Care homes are about the most vulnerable, and he was popular with staff and residents alike. Innes visited each home 3 times per year to meet residents and care home managers. He oversaw the construction of a brand new home in Croydon, increased overall occupancy, and opened care homes to public fee-paying residents for the first time. Our most significant achievement was making sure that every single person in the organisation put the residents first, he says. All of our policies, procedures and actions were focused on making sure we provided the best possible care. To this day, every one of our homes is graded either good or outstanding. Innes isn't a Freemason, but after joining the RMBI, he discovered some family history of Freemasonry. When I was offered the job, I told my mother, and that's when she told me that my grandfather had been a Freemason, says Innes. I hadn't known that, as he came from a generation of Masons that didn't really talk about it. Over 12 years, I have learnt a lot about Freemasonry and the values that underpin it, and I'm entirely supportive of all of those. They sit comfortably with the values of the charity world. In recent years, Freemasonry has become more open and confident, and the MCF has played an important role in this outgoing approach. The charity was formed in 2016 following 2 reports that explored future possibilities for the 4 Masonic charities: the Freemasons Grand Charity, RMBI, Masonic Samaritan Fund, and the Royal Masonic Trust for Girls and Boys. It became clear to all 4 Masonic charities that Freemasonry would be better supported by a single charity, says Innes. We wanted to provide an easier system for our beneficiaries, as every charity had different principles and application processes. The Masonic Charitable Foundation emerged from this rationalisation, and Innes saw off strong competition to be appointed chief executive. His first job was to oversee the integration process and launch of the new organisation. It was no mean task, says Newman. The 4 charities had 500 years of history between them. He put together a senior leadership team and was instrumental in establishing the structure of how this huge new charity was going to work and how it would interact with trustees, the Masonic community, UGLE, and beneficiaries. We suddenly had this huge charity with assets of more than £400 million. It was quite a beast. It's a challenge that Innes says he relished. His experience in the Royal Engineers and at the RMBI meant he understood both how to execute a major change management integration project, but also appreciated the context in which it was being done. Innes needed to ensure the 4 old charities continued to operate while integrating them under the MCF, where there would be new grant-making processes, new financial processes, and a new staff culture. In the end, we provided our stakeholders with a single point of contact, a single set of guidelines, and single application process, says Innes. We have made it much easier for our beneficiaries to access help, and we have created a new brand. The other key achievement was that we provided a force for Freemasonry in the charity sector. We are able to take part in policy debate at a national level. These were our goals, and I'm proud we achieved them. Innes singles out his leadership team, as well as the extraordinary generosity of Freemasons, as an essential contributory factor to the success of the MCF. Freemasonry has given an average of around £45 million in donations over the past 3 years to a wide range of causes, and all of that money is raised within the Masonic community. Innes is particularly proud of delivering an additional £3 million of support to community causes during the tercentenary year, as well as the overwhelming generosity of Freemasons during the COVID-19 pandemic that has funded so many worthwhile causes. He decided to step down to give his successor time to develop and then implement a 5-year strategy that will take the MCF through to 2027. Newman will be sad to see him go. David has been very supportive of Freemasonry. He is hugely professional, very much a leader, genuinely caring, extremely well organized, very charming, calm, open, honest, and has huge integrity, he says. He expresses all the values we have within the MCF. He is an individual thoroughly worth knowing. As for Innes, what will he most miss about the MCF following his socially distanced leaving party in the autumn? Charity is all about the support we provide, he says. When I see the people we have been able to help, when I visit them and see what the Masonic community has achieved, that is absolutely fantastic. That, undoubtedly, is what I will miss the most.
Page 35 starts the next section called A Daily Advancement, Extending Knowledge of Freemasonry. And we have 5 articles here: Learnings in Lockdown, Notes on a Scandal, Order of the Secret Monitor, Museum of Freemasonry, and Masonry and Morality. So the first of those articles is entitled Learning in Lockdown. While in-person lectures and talks were temporarily suspended, the Quatuor Coronati community adapted and has thrived online, as Dr. Rick Berman explains. The decision to suspend all Masonic meetings and the more general lockdown posed a particular challenge to research lodges and especially Quatuor Coronati. Given the attendance at our meetings is dominated by visitors, many of whom are from overseas. To make matters worse, we had spent more than a year planning our biannual conference, which in 2020 was to be held in Boston, Massachusetts. A raft of speakers from around the world had agreed to participate. The venue had been booked, catering organised, publicity was in full swing, and around a third of the tickets had been sold by March when we took the decision to pull the event. Although the conference was not scheduled to take place until September, it was obvious that anyone booking flights and hotels from that point would not be covered by travel insurance if we had been forced to cancel nearer the date, either as a result of ongoing restrictions or a renewed upsurge in cases of COVID-19. In addition, we felt it would be wrong to impose an unnecessary burden on the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, who were kindly hosting the event, with up to 300 attendees flying in from all over North America and internationally. We refunded those who had booked and spoke or wrote to our speakers to suggest putting together a selection of some of the papers that would have been delivered in Boston. I am pleased to say this is going well, and we hope to make the book available by the end of the year. The cancellation also triggered a suggestion from our friends at the Grand Lodge of California, who offered to host a virtual QC conference to be broadcast to their members and internationally. We discussed this with them and concluded that one of the key benefits of a conference is the physical get-together of like-minded people and the interaction and discussions that it can spark. This can't be replicated easily online, no matter how good the software. Instead, we agreed to produce a summer season of talks, one per week over August. Back in England, the papers that would have been delivered at QC's physical lodge meetings and the Q&A that would have followed were moved online. Talks by our speakers were pre-recorded and made available on QC's YouTube channel. Zoom sessions with up to 300 participants were hosted by this year's Master of the Lodge, Andreas Onifers. On 14th of May, the first speaker was Dr. Ola Vikander, an academic at Lund University in Sweden. His paper explored the connections between Masonic ritual and the ancient Northwest Semitic literary tradition. Next was Professor Aubrey Newman, a doyen of Masonic research in Britain, who in June spoke about the power division between provincial Grand Lodges and Grand Lodge. QC has not been alone in going online to feed the demand for Masonic education and research. Other ventures have sprung up, many driven by members of QC's Correspondence Circle, an international Masonic research community that's open to all. David Chichinadze of the Grand Lodge of Georgia, which celebrates its 5th anniversary this year, has been especially active, arranging twice weekly lectures, including a series of entertaining lectures from Bob Cooper, the curator of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, another member of QC Lodge. Lectures are streamed live on YouTube and feature a post-lecture discussion on Zoom. All past talks are available on the Grand Lodge of Georgia's YouTube channel. Open Lectures on Freemasonry, Open LFM, an international collaboration driven by members of the Grand Lodge of Turkey, has featured speakers from around the world, including several members of Quatuor Coronati Lodge. The talks are in English and each lecture lasts for around 25 minutes, followed by a 15-minute Q&A session moderated by the session chair. The lectures are live on Zoom, with past lectures available on SoundCloud and YouTube. The venture has proved so successful that OpenLFM is scheduling lectures into 2021. The United States has also been to the fore. Ben Williams at the Rocky Mountain Mason in Colorado has been producing live weekly podcasts, and the Grand Lodge of California has instigated a Masonic speaker series with live online lectures open to all. The programme began in April and has included George Boyes Stones, this year's Prestonian lecturer, speaking on A System of Morality, Aristotle and the Making of the Ritual, and Andreas Onifors on The Development of Scandinavian Freemasonry. July's lectures included a talk from Teresita Arachija, co-founder and grandmaster of the first exclusively female Grand Lodge of Freemasonry in California, which was launched in 2017, and a symposium, Masons of the Gold Rush. We can also highlight QCCC India, which has arranged a series of online events under the tagline Freemasonry Without Borders, that includes talks by UGLE's David Staples and Graham Redman. Ingenuity and hard work has allowed us to maintain and extend our Masonic education and research, as well as our international relationships in these tough times. It bodes well for the future.
On page 38, Notes on a Scandal. Poet Lord Byron wasn't the only controversial character in his family. His great-uncle William, 5th Lord Byron, killed a cousin in a duel, and as Grand Master, brought about a decline in English Freemasonry, explains Dr. Rick Berman. The mid and late 1740s were not ideal for Freemasonry. In 1746, a lack of suitable candidates for Grand Master led to Lord Cranston being asked to remain in office for another year. Grand Lodge itself had become notably ill-attended. Many members were fighting in Flanders, but Masonic malaise was also at fault, with quarterly communications dominated by the exclusion of lodges that seemed recalcitrant. In 1747, matters deteriorated further, with a motion passed to discontinue the procession to the annual Grand Feast, and William, 5th Lord Byron, 1722-1798, proposed as the new Grand Master. The decision to stop the annual procession was due to the growth of anti-Masonic protests, particularly the activities of the scald miserable Masons, whose satirical processions lampooned Freemasonry.
From the London Daily Post, 20th of March, 1741. Yesterday, some mock Freemasons marched through Pall Mall and the Strand as far as Temple Bar in procession. First went fellows as jackasses with cow's horns in their hands, then a kettle drummer on a jackass having two butter firkins for kettle drums, then followed two carts drawn by jackasses having in them the stewards with several badges of their order, then came a mourning coach drawn by six horses, each of a different size and colour, which were the Grand Master and Wardens, the whole attended by a vast mob. They stayed without Temple Bar until the Masons came by and paid their compliments to them, who returned the same with an agreeable humour.
Responding to the possibility of ridicule, Byron invited those attending his installation to meet him in the city, rather than process from his St. James's townhouse. And although the press recorded the elegant entertainment, the event was held in private. Byron began positively, promising that he would, to the utmost of his power, promote the benefit of the craft. But this undertaking was broken almost immediately, and Byron attended Grand Lodge on only a single occasion thereafter, on the 16th of March, 1752, when he proposed Lord Carisfort as his successor. During the intervening 5 years, Grand Lodge would fall under the domain of others, with press coverage muted and limited public interest, Byron's five-year absence setting a seal on English Freemasonry's mid-century decline. Byron had inherited his title aged 14, and volunteered for the Navy 2 years later, serving in the Mediterranean and off West Africa. Although promoted to lieutenant, he resigned on reaching his majority in 1743. Back in England, Byron's principal diversions were gambling and horse racing, with one paper noting his presence at Burford Races in Gloucestershire shortly after his return.
From the London Daily Post and General Advertiser, 6th of October, 1743. The field was honoured with the presence of the Duke of Beaufort, Duke Hamilton, Earl of Lichfield and brothers, Earl of Portmore, Earl of Shrewsbury, Lord Gower, Lord Chedworth and brothers, Lord Byron, Lord Castlehaven, Lord Craven, Lord Noel Somerset, Lord Barrington, great numbers of baronets, members of Parliament and the gentlemen of the best fashion in all the adjacent counties who diverted themselves with hawking or hind-hunting every morning, racing at noon, dining together every day to the number of 200, and concluding their nights at the town hall, where there was a grand ball and entertainment for the ladies, whose beauty, richness of apparel, and heights of spirits rendered the whole meeting most agreeable, as well as the most magnificent that has been seen for many years.
Within 2 years, Byron had moved from spectator to participant. The London Evening Post of the 2nd of April 1745 describes a 4-horse, 3-heat, 50-guinea sweepstake in which he competed, and there were numerous similar events throughout the late 1740s and into the 1750s across Britain's racecourses. Masonically, Byron was not a positive role model. 2 decades later, the Complete Freemason assessed his time in office as very inactive, commenting that several years passed by without his coming to a grand assembly, nay, he even neglected to nominate his successor. In Byron's absence, Grand Lodge's negative transformation continued. Horace Walpole noted that Freemasons were in so low repute now in England that nothing but a persecution could bring them into vogue again. Where only a decade earlier English Freemasonry had occupied social, political and intellectual heights, by the 1740s it was in a spiral of decline that did not reverse for decades. Byron's return to Grand Lodge in 1752 was nonetheless marked by an upsurge in attendance, with 56 lodges represented by 166 masters and wardens. The Grand Feast was also reinstated. Although not relevant to his Freemasonry, the fifth Lord Byron is known best for a drunken duel in 1765 with his cousin and fellow Freemason, William Chaworth, resulting in the latter's death. Byron was arrested and tried in the House of Lords. He was found guilty of manslaughter, fined and discharged under the Statute of Privilege. Following the trial, Byron's marriage collapsed. His wife left him, and his son, from whom he was estranged, and grandson predeceased him. The title and a mortgaged Newstead Abbey, the family seat, were inherited by George Gordon Byron, the poet, who became the sixth Lord Byron.
Page 40 starts the article entitled The Brotherhood of David and Jonathan. Have you ever wondered why some Freemasons wear a bow and arrow lapel pin? Dan Heath provides the story behind this and more with his spotlight on the Order of the Secret Monitor. In 1 Samuel 18 we read, "And it came to pass, when he, David, had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." In this short piece of biblical verse, cementing the friendship between David, father of Solomon, and Jonathan, son of Saul, that we find the essence of the ritual and teachings of the Order of the Secret Monitor, or Brotherhood of David and Jonathan, in the British Isles and its districts and conclaves overseas. The very earliest workings of an order based on the story of David and Jonathan appear to stem from the practices of Dutch Protestants in the Netherlands during the late 16th century, and several orders, brotherhoods and societies based on the same story began to appear over the next 200 years. It was Dr. Isaacar Zachary who brought the foundations for the modern order to England from America. Born in Chatham, Kent, to Jewish parents who had converted to Christianity and emigrated to America, Zachary was a former chiropodist general to the United States Army who had served in the American Civil War. On the 5th of May, 1887, Zachary invited 14 brethren to attend a meeting at his house at 80 Brook Street, London, where they formed the Alfred Meadows Conclave. The first Grand Council was constituted on the 17th of June that same year, and the opening meeting of the Grand Council held a few weeks later on the 2nd of July, where Zachary was installed and proclaimed Grand Supreme Ruler, a position he would hold until 1894. The order had a slightly turbulent time towards the end of the century, as perceived disagreements between it and other Masonic orders caused a ruling to be made that it should be incorporated into the Order of the Allied Masonic Degrees, though retaining an independent Grand Council within the AMD. This situation lasted until 1931, when the Grand Council of the Order of the Secret Monitor was granted independence as the sole and supreme authority over the degree of Secret Monitor in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland and the Dominions, colonies and dependencies of the British Crown. Although its title has changed, this is very much the same body that governs the Order today. Now, covering the British Isles and its districts and conclaves overseas, it's worth noting that it's the only order administered from Mark Mason's Hall, which has provinces in Scotland working under its constitution. The overriding premise of the order is that of friendship and care, brotherly love in its truest form, as evinced in the story of David and Jonathan. This message is amplified during a brother's induction into the order, when he is obligated to keep watch for and warn any brother about to perform an act that may be so detrimental to himself or another, and, if so warned by a brother, to take heed and to offer sympathy, warning, caution or aid to a brother in need. This engaging friendliness is further highlighted in the Order's name for the Supreme Being, the Almighty Friend of all friends. The close attention to the care and well-being of brethren is taken a step further in the duties of the four visiting deacons, similar to those duties attributed to the almoner in a craft lodge. These officers are peculiar to the order, and they are specially charged on their appointment to see that this fundamental object of the order is carried into practical effect during their term of office. To assist them, the membership of the conclave is divided into four, and each quarter ascribed to one of the visiting deacons so they can carry out this unique duty. So high is the importance of this aspect of the order that the faithful discharge of these duties is enshrined in the constitutions and regulations. There are three degree ceremonies within the order, that of induction, based upon the story of David and Jonathan, which is related through the ritual of the degree, the ceremony of admission, or prince's degree, which continues the biblical story from the book of Samuel, and finally the ceremony of installation, which is unique in mainstream English Freemasonry, as it is also the third degree of the order. During the ceremony, the newly installed supreme ruler of the conclave, equivalent to a worshipful master of a craft lodge, is further commissioned as a supreme ruler within the order by a grand officer, giving him the authority to preside in any conclave, not just his own. A conclave meeting is easily distinguished by the layout of the furniture, centred around a floor cloth bearing the seal of Solomon or shield of David, upon which is set a stone easel. Collectively, this depicts the holy ground for the purpose of our ceremonies. The regalia is quite simple, reflecting the pleasantly humble nature of the order. A brother of the first degree wears a breast jewel appended to a ribbon of three equal stripes, violet, Indian yellow and violet, which is usually loaned until he becomes a prince of the order, when the jewel is exchanged for one of the same design, but the colours of the ribbon are inverted. Officers wear sashes during the ceremony, the colour of which vary depending upon which degree is being worked. Provincial and grand officers wear a sash of Empire Blue or Medici Crimson, respectively, and collarette. So, what about the bow and arrow lapel pin? This story is central to the ritual of the first degree and can be found in the Book of Samuel, but the best way to find out more would be to join the order and share in the very special friendship that is its most enduring characteristic. And adjacent to this article is a quick fact file. Who's in charge? The Most Worthy Grand Supreme Ruler, Andrew Christopher Sweeney. He is assisted by the Right Worthy Deputy Grand Supreme Ruler, James Robert Hodge, and the Right Worthy Assistant Grand Supreme Ruler, Gaspar Llewellyn Gill. Who can join? The order is open to Master Masons raised to that degree in a regular lodge and who are in good standing of a regular lodge. How big is the order? Well, currently there are 357 conclaves in the order across 33 provinces in the British Isles, 5 districts and including 28 unattached conclaves. They stretch from New Zealand, the Philippines, Hong Kong and Singapore through India and South Africa into the Mediterranean, Western Europe and Scandinavia and then across to the Caribbean islands. There are also several sovereign grand conclaves in other parts of the world. And you can get further information from the book 125 Years of the Order of the Secret Monitor by Brian C. Wright, BSc. And it's available from the shop at Mark Mason's Hall or online at www.markmasonshall.org/orders/secret-monitor.
On page 42. Rights on the Road. Through the journey of a Bible and the warrant within, the Museum of Freemasonry's Louise Pichel tells how an 18th century lodge could meet wherever a battle took its brothers. To me, there is no document more important to a lodge than its warrant. Without one, meetings can't be held, and the examples I see arriving into the museum are often elaborately framed or accompanied by a specially made embossed leather pouch to keep it safe. Alongside details of a lodge name and number, warrants also state the place where the lodge intends to meet. On a modern warrant, you usually see the name of a Masonic hall specifically built for the purpose. Back in the 18th century, things were a little different. Although many lodges at that time were meeting in fixed places, usually the local tavern, there were others where such a place of meeting was impossible. At this time, a number of lodges were springing up in military regiments, ones that travelled to wherever the battles took them. For these lodges, their regiment was the meeting place, their camp the lodge room. The warrants for these were known as travelling warrants, and they would accompany regiments wherever they went. As well as a warrant, a lodge also needs a volume of sacred lore to be able to hold a meeting. When delving into the museum's strong rooms for items to display in our Treasures exhibition, we came across this beautiful Bible, inscribed, "The Gift of Brother William Morgar to Lodge 351. Opening the exquisite red Moroccan leather covers, we found pockets at both the front and back. Tucked safely in one of these was a document dated 1796, which revealed itself to be a travelling warrant. We were expecting the warrant to relate to the lodge that presented the Bible, but this turned out not to be the case. Research uncovered that not only did they relate to different lodges, but they were Irish and Scottish rather than English constitution. Lodge 351 was granted a warrant by the Grand Lodge of Ireland in 1760 and met in the 18th Royal Irish Regiment of Foot. Their travelling warrant allowed them to meet wherever they were garrisoned, which turned out to be pretty varied. When the lodge was formed, the regiment was in Ireland, but by 1767 it was in Philadelphia, lending a hand during the American War of Independence in 1775. They returned to Britain in 1782, but didn't stay for long. Spain laid siege to Gibraltar from 1779 until 1783, and in 1784 the Royal Irish and the Lodge were sent to Gibraltar to strengthen the garrison. They stayed until 1793, and it was during this period that the Lodge received the Bible from William Morga, a member of the regiment and probably also a member of the Lodge. The membership registers don't survive for this period, so, unfortunately, probably is the best we can do. So, we know the 18th foot were the first owners of the Bible, but the warrant inside suggests that it was passed on to a lodge in the 100th Regiment of Foot, under the Provincial Grand Lodge of Andalusia in Spain. The 100th was a Scottish regiment known as the Gordon Highlanders, after their first commander, George Gordon, Marquess of Huntly. In 1796, the regiment was stationed in Gibraltar, where the men decided to form their lodge. Perhaps when the 18th Royal Irish moved on, they left their Bible behind. We may never know the full story of how these two items came together, but to me, their history shows how a lodge's place to meet is less about a geographical location and more about the people and the objects they bring with them. The William Morga Bible and Warrant are part of the museum's special library exhibition, Treasures, which is available to see in full on our website, along with all our other exhibitions, at museumfreemasonry.org.uk/whats-on. You will be able to admire the item in person when we reopen to the public following the coronavirus lockdown.
Masonry and Morality. The 2020 Prestonian Lecture was delivered to a global audience by Professor George Boys Stones via video conferencing, a first in Masonic history. The Prestonian Lecture is the only lecture given under the authority of the United Grand Lodge of England. The lectureship is a memorial to William Preston, 1742-1818, who was regarded as the foremost Masonic educator of his age and who left a legacy to Grand Lodge to perpetuate his system of ritual lectures. The selection procedure for lecturers was altered in 2018, and the Provincial Grand Masters, Metropolitan Grand Master and the Secretary of Quatuor Coronati Lodge, number 2076, now submit names of possible speakers. The lectureship lasts for one calendar year, and the majority of Prestonian lecturers are members of the Quatuor Coronati Lodge. The appointed speaker gives several official deliveries of his lectures during his tenure, as determined by Grand Lodge, and is the main business of the Lodge at the meeting. The first scheduled presentation of the 2020 Prestonian Lecture was due on the 30th of May at the South Wales Provincial Grand Stewards Lodge number 8900 in the Masonic Province of South Wales. However, because of the COVID-19 pandemic and the declaration by the Grand Master of a suspension of the meeting of Masonic Lodges and Chapters for a period of 4 months from the 17th of March, it seemed as if this and all other deliveries of the 2020 Prestonian Lecture would need to be postponed. Since the start of the lockdown period, video conferencing has become increasingly important for people to keep in touch, whether it be in a business context or socially, Zoom and Microsoft Teams being the platforms of choice. It seemed, therefore, a natural progression for the inaugural delivery of the 2020 Prestonian Lecture to be delivered to members via video conferencing. And so it was that the official presentation of the 2020 Prestonian Lecture by Professor George Boys Stones was given to an audience of more than 100 registered attendees. It was delivered live on the scheduled day of 30th of May 2020 to a global audience using Zoom and was hosted by the South Wales Provincial Grand Stewards Lodge number 8900. This marked a major milestone for the Prestonian Lecture, the first time it had been delivered virtually to a global live audience. Professor George Boys Stones is Professor of Classics and Philosophy at the University of Toronto. He's a leading scholar of ancient philosophy, having gained an MA at Cambridge and a DPhil at Oxford University. His research interests lie in the philosophical movements of the post-Hellenistic period. Before moving to Toronto, he was Professor of Ancient Philosophy in the Department of Classics and Ancient History at Durham University and is a prolific author and editor with numerous titles to his name. Professor Boys Stones was initiated into the Apollo University Lodge No. 357, Oxford, in 1992 while a graduate student at Oxford, and was Master of the Lodge in 1997. He's a past Master of University's Lodge Durham and a founding member of the David Kenneth Williamson Lodge No. 9938, London. He has Grand Rank in Craft, PAGDC, and Royal Arch, PGSTB, and is also a member of the Ancient and Accepted Rite, Knights Templar, Mark Master Masons, and Royal Arch Mariners. He also sat on the committees for the university's scheme and general purposes. Professor Boys Stone's lecture postulated that English Freemasonry defines itself as a system of morality. But what does that phrase mean? This new study traced it back to the work of William Preston, who argued that Freemasonry teaches a philosophical approach to virtue. According to Preston, the rituals of Freemasonry are designed to lead the initiate through the ethical thought of Aristotle. His view proved popular and was decisive in shaping the ritual approved for use by the United Grand Lodge of England shortly after its formation in 1813. Almost all English lodges, and many others throughout the world, still use a ritual derived from this one and, perhaps without realising it, continue to pay silent testimony to Preston and to Aristotle in their work. There are to be only three official deliveries of the 2020 Prestonian Lecture, the other two being to lodges in London and West Kent. It was an honour and privilege to the province of South Wales that the first delivery was hosted by one of its lodges. Those who attended were privileged to see and hear Professor Boys Stones take them on a fascinating and scholarly journey through the early Masonic constitutions and manuscripts leading up to Preston's iteration of 1813. It culminated in Preston's characterization of the three degrees, following Aristotle's influence, as a journey of discovery of himself as a man, his inner moral code, and his wider reflection on his outer guiding light. The Provincial Grand Master for the Province of South Wales, Gareth Jones OBE, who attended the online presentation, said, "Members of South Wales and I are honoured that the first delivery of the prestigious 2020 Prestonian Lecture was hosted by the South Wales Provincial Grand Steward's Lodge. I am grateful to Professor Boys Stones for delivering such a thought-provoking lecture in the way he did, across time zones from his home in Toronto. I would also like to extend my grateful thanks to my provincial grand orator, Merrick Jones, and his learning and development team, who organised and hosted the whole event." Page 47 starts the Grand Lodge section of the magazine, News from Great Queen Street. And there are four articles. First, in quarterly communication, we have a letter from the Grand Master, His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent, on spirit and values. Then we have the Royal Arch section, remembering the contributions of Lawrence Dermot. Preserving Digital History has new software, the museum can archive digital memories, and Learning and Discovery, Solomon is providing a broad programme of content for members.
On page 49, a letter from the Grand Master, His Royal Highness, the Duke of Kent. "Brethren, it is just over 4 months since I took the regrettable but inevitable step of suspending Freemasonry in response to the coronavirus. Since then, I have been enormously impressed by and immensely proud of the way in which our members, both at home and throughout our districts, have manifested and even amplified the spirit and values of our ancient institution. In particular, you have demonstrated that our charitable instincts and actions are indeed the defining characteristic of a Freemason's heart. The ways that you have kept in touch with each other, caring especially for brethren who were alone and vulnerable, and, more widely, the ways in which you have selflessly helped and served your local communities, have greatly impressed many beyond the craft itself. I am sure that we all regret that we are not yet back to where we were before this virus struck. Not least, we so miss the camaraderie of dining together. It is a sad reality, however, that things will probably need to remain different to what we have been used to for some considerable time yet. You will know that UGLE has recently promulgated guidance for lodges that wish to meet again, and even to conduct ceremonies. I fully understand that some members will feel that the time is not yet right for them to return to Masonic labour, or that the necessary restrictions in ceremonial would detract too much from their impact. I am equally sure, though, that they will join me in wishing all brethren well as we chart our different journeys through this period, keeping the light of Freemasonry alive until we are all able to meet again. We must have faith that this period will pass, as most surely it will. Freemasonry has weathered many storms and has evolved and adapted over the centuries. We will be the stronger for coming through this time of trial, and it is that hope and confidence that now sustains us. The principles which have guided the many generations of Masons that have gone before us are just as true, just as relevant, and just as needed in today's world as ever they have been. Brethren, I wish you a happy, healthy, and enjoyable summer, and look forward to seeing you as soon as circumstances permit in the new season. Sincerely and fraternally yours, His Royal Highness, the Duke of Kent.
Charity in Freemasonry starts on page 51. The Metropolitan Grand Chapter's Rob Soames looks to the Met GC's Lawrence Dermot, enigma and trailblazer, for clarity on Freemasonry's charitable origins. The Met GC research project, which resulted in the book Lawrence Dermot, Enigma and Trailblazer, didn't start with the question of when Freemasonry became a charitable organisation. We just wanted to know more about Lawrence Dermot. But his focus on charity was an important consequence. Dermot was Grand Secretary of the Aintients Grand Lodge, which was set up in 1751 because many Masons, especially London Irish ones, were dissatisfied with the 1717 Moderns Grand Lodge. The two English Grand Lodges remained in opposition until 1813, when the Royal Dukes of Kent and Sussex, each a Grand Master, brought them together as the United Grand Lodge of England. Had Dermot been less influential in the 1750s, some of us wonder if Freemasonry as we know it would still exist. The status of the Royal Arch degree was the cause of the schism. Was it integral to the third degree, as the Aintients contended? Or was it, as the Moderns said, a separate degree? What they agreed is still in every book of constitutions as the rather ambiguous preliminary declaration. There were many differences between the two Grand Lodges in the mid-1800s, and most of Dermot's story, which nowadays is not well known, is about craft masonry. Yet craft and Royal Arch masonry today is mostly based on what he achieved between 1752 and 1771, especially regarding the organised approach to charity that we still use. Dermot was an impoverished Irish Mason who came to London in about 1748 to find work. Like many others, he found that the lodges of the time had many well-off gentry-class Masons, but neither they nor he were comfortable together. So when he and those like him set up the Aintients Grand Lodge, they focused on the needs of Masons most like themselves. If you lived hand to mouth and were ill or lost your job, you and your family risked homelessness and starvation. As an Irishman who had survived the 1739 to 1740 Great Frost in Ireland, which had killed 1 million people, who knew at first hand the second-class treatment the Irish received from the English, Dermot knew all about prejudice and poverty. So the new Grand Lodge agreed that each sick member would receive 1 penny per week. In January 1753, they agreed that every member would give 4 pence a month towards creating a charity fund. A month later, they authorised the officers to pay 10 shillings a week, 1 shilling, then is about £5 now, in value, to a sick member, and 7 shillings to those in debtors' prisons, costs to be recovered from the charity fund. To cover this, every member had to pay 1 shilling per meeting, and lodges paid 2 shillings 6 pence for each newly made Mason and 1 shilling for joining members. Dermot was a first-class administrator. He introduced practices that we routinely follow today. The minutes of the ancients during Dermot's lifetime, he died in 1791, show that he personally made the following proposals. First, each approved lodge had to be registered with Grand Lodge via a warrant issued for an official fee. Members received initiation certificates. New opportunities arose. British soldiers and sailors serving overseas wanted a link with home. Dermot issued them with warrants and certificates. By 1789, there were 50 lodges in the USA alone. Many still continue. Second, effective lodges need clear, up-to-date lodge bylaws. Dermot set the model. Third, good ritual encourages membership. He led from the front, travelling around England to set up and instruct lodges. Above all, it was his financial probity which made his reputation. It enabled the ancients to pay their way. By 1789, there were 289 lodges, and regular Masonic giving to charity is part of that legacy. Dermot was a trailblazer, and although his work has largely been forgotten, our researcher has uncovered a fuller story. Give to charity and get a copy of the book from Freemasons Hall, or email dermot1720@gmail.com.
On page 52, Preserving Moments in Time. The Museum of Freemasonry's archivist and records manager, Susan Snell, on how new software is turning digital content into a richly documented memory bank. When lockdown first started, we received several inquiries asking about how Freemasonry coped with the Spanish flu a century ago. That pandemic caused the deaths of more than 200,000 people in Britain, mainly adults between the ages of 20 and 30. These included soldiers returning from World War I and women working in factories, on farms, and in transportation. We searched for information in the UGLE archives, but could find very little. We realised then the importance of capturing the response to COVID-19 today, how Freemasons are coping with virtual meetings and helping to support local communities. 100 years on, the way members are communicating has certainly changed. Information is shared instantly through emails and social media platforms. We are using new ways to communicate, often for the first time. We now exchange emails with confidence, participate with enthusiasm in Zoom meetings, comment on Facebook posts, and join conversations on Twitter. Whereas UGLE's archives preserve the physical copy letters, minutes, and memos from a century ago, modern social media posts are at risk of disappearing tomorrow. So, how do we make sure that we don't lose the rich records created by members and UGLE staff during this crisis? Just before lockdown, the museum's archives began using new software, Preservica, to help us safeguard digital resources permanently. Using this, we can capture any digital content and maintain it for future access. Even if the format of digital documents changes over time, the new software enables us to migrate resources so we will be able to continue to read them. This solution helps us to preserve our corporate memory and prevents the loss of digital records. We can save websites, digital newsletters, videos, Twitter feeds, and other items. These resources will help us to record information about how you are living through lockdown and what you are doing to help locally. The communications teams at UGLE and the Masonic Charitable Foundation are also sending us digital resources. These include electronic newsletters sent to members and staff. We are keen to preserve items such as letters sent by provinces to members, newsletters, diaries recording life during lockdown, and video recordings. If you can contribute something, please let us know what you are sending, who is included, when it was made, and where it is from. You can send us large documents with lots of images, as well as WhatsApp messages, to a number that we can provide. We've also set up an email address for this project, which is covid@museumfreemasonry.org.uk. We're also interested in collecting physical items for our museum collection, such as brochures, hand washing posters, lapel pins, t-shirts, and PPE with logos. Please make sure you have permission to collect this material. This is especially important for images of community activities, lockdown recollections, and details of hardship experiences due to the pandemic. This is a difficult time for many. Let's do it in a sensitive and ethical way. Let people know what you are collecting and why. Explain that you are trying to keep a record of this unique situation and respect there may be some high emotions involved. To find out how to get started, read the museum's webpage about our exciting initiative at museumfreemasonry.org.uk/our-COVID-19-story.
And just a side note, the 19 of that address is the digit 1 and the digit 9, not the word 19. Then we come to page 54, and this article is entitled Fostering Curiosity, Developing Understanding. Since its successful launch 18 months ago, Solomon has evolved to become far more than a library of static content. Click and learn with your new interactive online resource. From its foundation of pure written material, Solomon has expanded to provide new ways of learning for new audiences, with material ranging from sound recordings to video and interactive content. We're always exploring fresh ways for our members to learn and make the content on Solomon interesting and engaging. At the same time, we break down every potential barrier to make our virtual learning environment, or VLE, as successful and accessible as possible. The learning and development team work hard to upload interesting and dynamic material in a variety of formats to satisfy the requirements of our members and ensure that there's something available for every style of learning. The content is divided into sections called modules, which you enrol onto, a process that takes only a few seconds. Once enrolled, any searches you make will automatically include all the material contained in your modules and exclude material in other modules, in other degrees, or the Royal Arch. You will also receive notification when your modules are updated with new content. In addition to the search functionality, Solomon has a tag system that enables you to follow your individual learning pathway and access related content. All of this gives you the chance to pursue a structured program, learning more about each degree as you progress through the ceremonies and onto the Royal Arch. Alternatively, you can explore specific or diverse interests which may be much more expansive and follow the symbolism behind the ritual, or delve into the history and traditions of Freemasonry. Everyone has their own style of learning, and it's part of our mission to enable every member to use Solomon whatever their individual method or objectives. For example, take a virtual walk through the layout of Lodge Room and its symbols before listening to Crackpots, an audio presentation of an ancient story taken from Indian and Chinese folklore. Or explore the quizzes, which range from the tracing boards to the jewels worn by the officers of the lodge. The complete collection of audio files can be downloaded with one click from the box set module and enjoyed on the go. The addition of the Prestonian lectures on Solomon means that you can also experience these fascinating talks on your computer or tablet. Members from across the globe can engage directly with the lecturers too, as the follow-up Q&A sessions with the Prestonian lecturers are also available. Solomon is not just for individual learning, however. It's important that we share our enjoyment of discovery with others in and beyond our own lodges and chapters. Webinars are being introduced for new users and will be expanded with the forthcoming Solomon User Group to help you get the most out of the system. Solomon can provide support for a broader program of learning and development within lodges and chapters, such as the following, for example, individual Masons, lodges, chapters, light blues and Masonic groups with an interest in sharing and broadening the understanding of their fellow members, provincial grand lodges and districts to help them share experience and deliver an effective program of education at a lodge and chapter level. Solomon is a resource format that provides a journey of discovery and understanding for everyone. recently, Solomon has taken on a new role as a resource for the enjoyment and instruction of individual brethren and as a supply of informative guidance and material for use at virtual gatherings and classes of instruction. Whether individually or as part of a group, our mission is to provide you with everything you need to continue your journey of Masonic learning and understanding. Fostering curiosity, developing understanding, is not simply the central message of Solomon, it is the core value that underpins everything we do. And then there's a sidebar with how to register. You can register by scanning the QR code supplied in the magazine with your mobile phone or copying solomon.ugle.org.uk into your browser address bar. You will not be able to find Solomon by searching for it on Google or the search line of your browser. Solomon is not registered on search engines and is only accessible directly from the address https://solomon.ugle.org.uk. On the front page, you'll see a 3-minute video, Register Your Account on the System, which will take you through the simple process of registration. Fill in your details. Once you've received the confirmation email, log in, select your first module, and enroll. If you're using a smartphone, you might want to download the free Adobe Acrobat Reader app first. This will ensure that the PDFs used on Solomon retain their format. Now we come to the culture section, which contains the book reviews. There are four this time. First of all, Freemasonry, Material, Moral and Mystical by Tony Baker. And then Rediscovered Rituals of English Freemasonry by David Harrison. The Collected Prestonian Lectures, Volume 5, 1997 to 2008. And Freemasonry, Initiation by Light.
The first book review is for Freemasonry, Material, Moral and Mystical by Tony Baker, and the review is by Reginald Church. Probing Perspectives, Exploring Deeper Messages and Meaning. One of the great delights about Freemasonry is that it does what it does on so many levels, often all at the same time, but equally often unfolding its thought-provoking aspects at different times as one progresses. On a simple level, it knits together charity, companionship, tolerance for others, history, and spirituality in a subtle blend that only makes real sense through what we actually do in the lodge room. If it didn't do this well, it would not have survived for 3 centuries. The author of this well-written and thoughtful book, Tony Baker, puts the blend as follows: fellowship, morality, charity, and something deeper. He focuses squarely on the latter. In other words, what happens in Lodge and Royal Arch chapter rooms and its implications, as it affects us as individuals. He is, however, careful not to lose sight of the importance of the historical, social, charitable, and moral aspects of Freemasonry, instead arguing that it is the more profound meaning and deeper messages of our ceremonies that underpin them. Baker suggests that true Freemasons are seekers who feel a sense of something missing, who have come to realize that they are not complete and so are therefore on a quest. Interestingly, he adds that perhaps the reason the United Grand Lodge of England does not tell its members what the ceremonies mean is that those deeper meanings are for individual Freemasons to find out for themselves. Many of us sense this in some way, however dimly. Baker's clear yet thought-provoking book may be just the thing to help bring that into sharper focus. I enjoyed it and would recommend it.
And the book, Freemasonry, Material, Moral and Mystical by Tony Baker, is published by Lewis Masonic, 170 pages at £19.99. Now we come to Rediscovered Rituals of English Freemasonry by David Harrison. And the review is by Jim Murray. 25 Degrees and Rising, Ideal Companion to Carlyle's Masonic Exposé. Prominent Masonic historian David Harrison takes the text of Richard Carlyle's Manual of Freemasonry, published in book form in 1845, to illustrate lost rituals from some 25 degrees, some of which, but not all, are known to me. Carlyle was a Republican, deist, and thorough nuisance to the authorities of the time. It is a mystery how such a character managed, as a non-Mason, to convince brethren to divulge the ceremonies they normally kept so secret. Perhaps there were some that were tongue-in-cheek. How many of us are au fait with the intricacies of the workings of the Royal Suspended Arch or the Herodian Order degrees, for instance? Actually, this is an intriguing read. First, Harrison examines in some detail the associates of Carlyle and how he may have sourced his understanding of the degrees. For example, he seems to have had quite some dealings with Thomas Paine, author of an essay on the origin of Freemasonry, who in turn was known to George Washington. The second part of Harrison's book describes the rituals. Though it is tempting to be sceptical, those of us who have a West Country background and are thus familiar with Bristol workings of both the craft and Royal Arch, veils and so on, could say that if parts are true, then why not the whole lot? Anyone looking to join the entire 25 degrees should therefore perhaps avoid this work. It could well take away precious eureka moments. Others will be spellbound. A welcome recent reprint of Carlyle's book itself was reviewed in the last edition of FMT. Annoyingly, it had no introduction, index, bibliography or footnotes. Harrison's book, therefore, makes an ideal and welcome companion to it. And The Rediscovered Rituals of English Freemasonry by David Harrison is published by Lewis Masonic, 153 pages at £19.99.
The third book review is for The Collected Prestonian Lectures, Volume 5, 1997 to 2008, and the review is by Sestrian. Brother Preston's Legacy, a welcome collection of prestigious lectures. William Preston, 1742 to 1818, was an intellectual. A well-educated printer and publisher from Edinburgh, in 1760 he came to London, where he was successfully in business with William Strawn, who was King's printer and publisher of Dr. Johnson's Dictionary. Preston was enormously active in Masonic circles at a time when Grand Lodge was endeavouring to consolidate its supremacy. It was fending off the challenge posed by the new boys on the block, who, rather impertinently, called themselves the Ancients. Grand Lodge, much the older institution, they called the Moderns. Eventually, this battle was essentially won by common sense, rather than either side. Both parties implicitly concluded that there would never be space for both Grand Lodges to flourish. On St. John the Evangelist's Day, 1813, they joined forces as United Grand Lodge of England. Preston was a noted Masonic teacher in his day, devising lectures in catechistic form to explain the proper ritual as he saw it. He was also master of the Lodge of Antiquity, now Number 2. When he died, Preston left £300 to establish an annual lecture, and, with two significant gaps, a Prestonian lecturer has been appointed every year since. It is rightly considered a uniquely prestigious appointment. We should be grateful to the Correspondence Circle of Quatuor Coronati Lodge, to the Board of General Purposes, and to Lewis Masonic for ensuring that the Prestonian Lectures, 1997 to 2008, with one exception, are reproduced in this, the fifth volume in the series. Here we read of history and philosophy, of societal developments, religion, and astonishing valour in the face of the enemy, of the image of Freemasonry in popular fiction, of the doings of our Grand Secretaries over time, and much else. It is a splendid collection, excellently edited. I heartily recommend it.
And once again, the book is The Collected Prestonian Lectures, Volume 5, 1997 to 2008, published by Lewis Masonic, 416 pages long, and the price is £15. And now the last of the four books. This one's called Freemasonry, Initiation by Light. It's by Christopher Earnshaw. A most interesting idea. Did Taoism influence early Freemasonry? The first part of Earnshaw's trilogy not only covers the development of speculative Freemasonry from the operative lodges rebuilding London following the Great Fire of 1666, but also what he sets out to show is the influence of Chinese Taoism on the ritual, particularly in the first degree. The historical setting is particularly interesting and engaging, covering the political and religious context of the era, including the Jacobite uprisings and the early days of the Hanoverian monarchy, one of the reasons the discussion of religion and politics was discouraged. The book stresses the difference between the speculative lodge, which met at the Horn Tavern in Westminster, and the three operative lodges, including accepted Masons, which met at pubs elsewhere in London. The rules of the Royal Society, scientific exploration and alchemy, are also covered, as is the emphasis on attracting members of the nobility to ensure the financial success and status of the fledgling society. The book additionally includes pen pictures of well-known historical figures who may have influenced the development of early Freemasonry. However, the wealth of information does become somewhat tangential and repetitive and would benefit from an edit. This doesn't mean it's difficult to read, quite the contrary, and short sections and narrative structure keep things moving briskly. Later chapters cover the history of China and Taoism and how the Chinese Mandarin Zhen Wuzong, who came to England in 1685, may have inadvertently played a significant role in the development of modern Freemasonry. This material is again interesting and engaging, but the narrative hinges on a large number of coulds, maybes and possibilities. There is an argument to be made, which is undoubtedly well done, but much of the evidence seems somewhat circumstantial. However, this should not distract from an interesting book, and I look forward to the rest of the series. And the review was by Richard Watkins, and the book Freemasonry, Initiation by Light, by Christopher Earnshaw, is self-published, 396 pages, and the price is £17.93.
On page 65, Response to a Growing Need. A £250,000 grant will help Mind deliver much-needed mental health services for those in crisis. Mental health support services in England and Wales are to receive a significant boost thanks to a generous grant of £250,000 from the Masonic Charitable Foundation in support of mental health charity Mind and its emergency appeal. Donations to help Mind and local Mind services now matter more than ever, as COVID-19 is increasingly affecting the nation's mental health. Demand for the services provided by Mind and local Mind groups has been unprecedented during the pandemic. More than 1 million people have accessed its online information on coronavirus and mental health, with many people seeking support through its online community since the crisis began. This increase in demand comes as social distancing measures have meant that other vital services, usually conducted face-to-face by local Mind groups, such as counselling, cannot be delivered. Mind's income has been affected by the outbreak of coronavirus, largely due to the closure of its 160 charity shops across England and Wales, and the cancellation or postponement of major fundraising events, including the London Marathon. The grant provided by the MCF, the Freemasons charity, will support a range of services both nationally and locally, helping improve accessibility and reach as many people in need as possible. In response to the significant demand created by the pandemic, Freemasonry is providing special funding of £2.75 million for projects that are helping those who are particularly affected by the crisis. This extra money comes in addition to the estimated £45 million given to charity every year by Freemasons. We're so grateful to the Freemasons for their generous donation to our emergency appeal, says Kathleen Miles, Director of Fundraising at Mind. We're facing huge demand for our advice and information about staying well and looking after your mental health. This grant will make sure we can not only keep our vital services running, especially those delivered by local Mind groups, but will also allow us to expand to meet growing need and help pick up the pieces when things start to return to normal.
Page 66 and an article called Together Again. New visitor pods at RMBI Care Co homes help residents reunite with their families. Residents at RMBI Care Co homes have been overjoyed to be reunited with their loved ones after 4 months without visitors. the care provider, which has no active cases of COVID-19 in its care homes at the time of writing, supports Freemasons and their dependents and is among the first in the country to install COVID-secure visitor pods, which enable residents to meet safely with their families again. RMBI Care Co's 18 care homes closed their doors to all but essential visitors before lockdown to ensure the safety of residents. Staff have worked tirelessly to support residents in maintaining regular contact with their families by phone or video call, but close-up, face-to-face conversations have not been possible. The newly created partitioned spaces have an airtight glass screen to ensure the safety of residents, their families, and the home's staff. Visitors enter and exit from outside of the home to minimise the risk of infection. Residents access the pods from a different door inside the home. The pods have an intercom system that allows residents and visitors to talk to each other easily. Both sides of the pods are deep cleaned between each visit. Most visitor pods have been installed by the home's facilities team, and some have been supported by the Association of Friends and local Freemasons. Among the residents who have been thrilled to have visitors again was Connie Jones at Albert Edward Prince of Wales Court in Bridgend, who was celebrating her 82nd birthday. Connie said, "It was wonderful to be able to see my sister again after such a long time. It was the best birthday present I could have wished for." Grace Amroth said, "It was fantastic to see my sister at last, just in time for her birthday. The new visiting room is great. The whole experience is really positive, and the home has done a brilliant job looking after Connie through the pandemic. I couldn't have asked for more." Mark Lloyd, Managing Director at RMBI Care Co, said, "Our teams have been working around the clock to find innovative ways to bring our residents safely back in contact with their loved ones. In normal times, our residents are able to have visitors whenever they like, so not being able to do that has been difficult for everyone. We hope our new secure visiting rooms will make it a bit easier for our residents and their families during these challenging times. We're also continuing to look at other ways to welcome visitors safely to our homes again, including making use of outdoor spaces."
On page 67, Hollywood's Feel Better Factor. Our £50,000 grant supports a bedside blockbuster film service for patients at Newcastle's Royal Victoria Infirmary. More than 2,000 NHS patients have been able to watch major Hollywood blockbusters from the comfort of their own beds at Newcastle's Royal Victoria Infirmary, thanks to a grant of £50,000 to the Medicinema charity. The money was awarded by Northumberland Freemasons with funding from the Masonic Charitable Foundation. With restrictions on visitors because of COVID-19, Medicinema has brought some much-needed escapism for patients on the wards. They have been able to view more than 5,600 hours of fantastic movies such as Toy Story 4, Ghostbusters, Paddington 2, The Lego Movie 2, and Moana via the Hospedia bedside service. Medicinema is a charity that builds and runs state-of-the-art cinemas in hospitals. The cinemas are designed with space for beds, wheelchairs, and equipment. Although they had to be suspended in mid-March because of the pandemic, they were quickly adapted to provide a new bedside service. Although the grant was originally awarded to help fund the in-hospital cinema screenings for children and young people, the suspension of this service means the money will now help Medicinema bring the magic of film to the bedsides of patients of all ages. "We're extremely grateful to the Freemasons for this generous grant," says Kat Mason, Chief Executive of Medicinema. "As well as keeping our bedside screening services running, it will also enable us to plan the safe reopening of our Royal Victoria Infirmary Medicinema and help fund paediatric screenings once the cinema is reopened." Helga Charters, Associate Director of Nursing and Children's Services at Newcastle Hospitals, says, "Having the Medicinema in our hospital has provided the most wonderful opportunity for children, young people and adults within our care the chance to have some welcome escapism from the treatment they are all undergoing. We're grateful that our patients can view new releases daily at their bedside. The feedback from children, families and adult patients has been incredibly positive. Medicinema works to progress patient resilience and recovery and improve well-being through film and the shared cinema experience. During their stays in hospital, patients, families, and carers can see the latest releases as well as classics. In a recent survey, 99% of respondents agreed that Medicinema makes a positive difference to their experience of the hospital. 93% said it helped reduce isolation, and 92% agreed that Medicinema helps to reduce anxiety and stress. Founded at St. Thomas Hospital in London in 1999, Medicinema operates at 6 hospitals across the UK.
Also on this page, children to enjoy camp in the cloud. More than 1,400 seriously ill children from all over the country who were scheduled to visit activity camps before the pandemic struck will now be able to enjoy a virtual online camp thanks to a grant of £70,000 awarded by Hampshire and Isle of Wight Freemasons with funding from the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF. Camp in the Cloud, run by Havant Charity Over the Wall, is a new and innovative virtual camp. It's a free, fun and interactive way of engaging children with serious illness through online activities. Camp in the Cloud combines the best of Over the Wall's therapeutic recreation camps with state-of-the-art learning technologies to help tackle the associated issues of health challenges in young people. The aim is to create an inclusive, accessible and engaging online program in parallel with a package of physical resources, including a T-shirt and activity materials sent by post, which allows campers and families to experience the magic of camp from their own home. John Whittaker, head of Hampshire and Isle of Wight Freemasons, says, thanks to this imaginative plan, well over 1,000 children with serious medical conditions will be able to enjoy themselves and benefit from the positive effects of the camps without risk of catching the virus.
On page 68, new MCF Chief Executive. Les Hutchinson will be the new Chief Executive of the Masonic Charitable Foundation following the retirement of David Innes in September. Les has been actively involved in Freemasons charities since he joined the Royal Masonic Trust for Girls and Boys as a management trainee in 1988, rising to become its Chief Executive. Following the creation of the MCF in 2016, Les has served as its Chief Operating Officer and has worked in close partnership with David Innes and the trustees to bring together the 4 separate Masonic charities into one single organisation. This appointment is an honour and privilege, says Les. David Innes will be a hard act to follow, but I will work tirelessly to ensure that the MCF continues to be a tremendous force for good, and to make a difference to so many communities and individuals. The MCF has also appointed John McCrohan to the position of Operations Director. John was previously Head of Strategy and Impact at the MCF, having been Grants Director and Deputy Chief Executive at the Masonic Samaritan Fund.
Middlesex Freemasons have raised £4.5 million to support disadvantaged children and young people. Pro-provincial Grandmaster Peter Baker confirmed the total for their 2020 festival appeal on a webcast after their celebration event, which was due to take place at Plaisterers Hall in London, was postponed due to COVID-19. The total raised per member during the 5-year appeal was £1,001. This is the second highest for any festival held to date. In a letter of thanks, His Royal Highness Prince Michael of Kent, Provincial Grand Master, said, "I am incredibly impressed by the generosity of all Middlesex Freemasons. I greatly appreciate the hard work and effort expended by all of you."
Free will writing moves online. To make the process of making a will as simple as possible, the Masonic Charitable Foundation works with the Goodwill Partnership to offer a free will writing service. To date, more than 300 individual wills have now been made using the service, at no cost to the willmaker or the beneficiaries. The process involves explaining your wishes to a trained Goodwill Partnership counsellor in the comfort of your own home. With social distancing measures in place, the service is now available via video call or telephone 7 days a week, daytime and evenings. To access the free will writing service, visit mcf.org.uk/legacy. Please use code MCF001 when contacting the Goodwill Partnership.
And finally, a note here at the end of this section. Can the MCF help you? If you are temporarily unable to work, facing redundancy, unable to access your pension, or struggling with additional household costs, the MCF may be able to help. You can contact the inquiries team today at help@mcf.org.uk or telephone 0800 035 6090. And finally, we come to the letters to the editor. And if you want to write, you can write to The Editor, FMT, Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street, London, WC2B5AZ, or email editor@freemasonrytoday.com. And a note at the bottom of this page, the opinions expressed here are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the views of the United Grand Lodge of England. All UGLE members' letters printed are appended with the contributor's name, his mother lodge name and number, the town where that lodge meets and the province. Please include those details at the foot of your letter and enclose a stamped addressed envelope for any items sent by mail that you wish to have returned.
Sir, I must congratulate you and your staff in producing the best magazine to date. Such a cross-section of articles, I was bowled over with its contents. So many interesting people from all walks of life, both present and past. The history of Freemasonry is outstanding. It has never exhibited any prejudices of any kind. A remarkable institution. During these unprecedented times, Freemasonry has come to the fore. How the uninformed can decry what we do is beyond me. Perhaps they should read the magazine. Mark Morris, Past Provincial Grand Registrar, Waverney Lodge, No. 929.
And David Lohman of St. Thomas Lodge, No. 4198, down in Exeter in Devon, writes, Sir, as a Mason of some 46 years, I was heartened to read such a well-thought-out letter from Trevor Black, Lodge No. 1040, in issue 49. I agree with Brother Black's opinion regarding the laissez-faire approach to the learning and striving for excellence in the deliverance of ceremonial ritual. His views need no repetition except to add a few personal comments. Unfortunately, embarrassing and demeaning ceremonies are often overlooked by the visiting hierarchy, lodge members and toast respondents in their misconceived beliefs that the workings have been performed with sincerity and all trying their best. Inadvertently, they're giving approval to and fueling the continuance of mediocrity. Like any visitor to a lodge, I have on many occasions been requested to reply to a toast. In order not to be rudely ungrateful for generous hospitality, I have chosen not to make reference to a poor ceremony in the vain hope that those present will read between the lines. Like Brother Black, I also have been involved with business, which committed me, my wife and partners 24/7 for 52 weeks a year. We also raised and educated 3 children. So if I, as someone of many interests and of average intelligence, can apply myself, why not the moderns? Of course, a committed minority do apply themselves and afford some hope for the future of Freemasonry and its traditions. I suggest that poor interviewing and the subsequent admission of debatably unsuitable candidates has led to a self-perpetuation of this disheartening state of affairs. Due diligence into the suitability of Freemasonry has been forfeited in a quest to recruit candidates. As I know to my cost, to express or offer any constructive advice risks being labelled one of the old codgers still locked in the 20th century. Brother Black's reference to provincial honours has also been of concern to me for a considerable time. I have no personal axe to grind, as I have received honours appropriate to my input. However, I am certainly critical of the provincial system and its arguably complicated method of recognising service to Masonry. I think the London Metropolitan Grand Lodge approach appears to be simpler, fairer, and less prone to the envy of preferment. Unfortunately, the provincial Grand Lodge system has at times led to inappropriate appointments and promotions at the expense of more worthy brethren. And once again, that's from David Lohman, St. Thomas Lodge, No. 4198 in Exeter, Devon.
Sir, I have wonderful memories of visits to the Navy Lodge with Captain David Swain, who I've known since we were 5 years old. I remember well the Almoner reading a lovely note in 1999 from the Queen Mother at Clarence House. She'd been 47 years a widow then, and thanked the brethren for their kind gift and thoughts. I also remember going to a double initiation. I was also at the festive board, and with not even the first toast taken, I was worried about missing my train up north. The DC ran through the whole toast list in less than 15 minutes, and I made it to Euston with minutes to spare. Anthony C. Taylor, Past Provincial Senior Grand Warden, Warwickshire.
And finally, this letter from Alan Brundle, Redcar Royal Arch Chapter Number 1244, Yorkshire North and East Ridings. Sir, the Pro First Grand Principal recently remarked that he looks forward to the day that he can boast that more than 50% of craft Freemasons have joined the Royal Arch. Other orders have separate dedicated provincial heads, while at present only approximately 50% of provinces have a separate head for both craft and chapter. Our first Grand Principal, His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent, is the Grand Patron of Rosicroix, which is divided into districts, each with separate heads. The Royal Arch in England and Wales is special. It is unique, for throughout most of the world the Royal Arch is associated with a second degree and Mark Masonry. In our constitution it's a completely separate order which is firmly attached to the craft. The Pro First Grand Principal's article was headed A Call to Action. So, is the time not fast approaching when the Royal Arch, while retaining the rulers and officers of Supreme Grand Chapter, moves to being a separate order in its own right and challenging the other Masonic orders head-on? Will the day come when a candidate for Freemasonry is initiated, passed, raised and exalted, and then one grand certificate issued for the candidate's complete journey of pure ancient Freemasonry? And as I said before, that's written by Alan Brundle, Redcar Royal Arch Chapter 1244, Yorkshire North and East Ridings. And that concludes this edition of FMT Magazine, issue number 51 for autumn 2020 from the UGLE. Thank you for listening.